is cute.
And back out again.
A dung pap from a cow is a really, really important habitat.
Join a cheesemaker, a philosopher, a scientist, and a farmer. Journey through a cow on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Sunday night at 7:15.
It's 6 o'clock on Tuesday, the 7th of April. Good morning. This is Today with Anna Foster and Justin Webb.
The headlines today.
Houston, integrity, comm check.
Integrity, we have you loud and clear. Hummy.
Houston, we have you the same, and it is so great to hear from Earth again.
That was the moment that communications between NASA's Artemis II astronauts and Earth were restored last night after 40 minutes in the dark on the far side of the moon. They've now begun their journey home. We'll hear direct from a British scientist at the heart of Mission Control.
It's a privilege to get to sit in those rooms. And, you know, it's sort of very humbling. And I felt just super honoured to be able to just be in there and, you know, see all these incredible sights.
One other headline: ahead of his deadline for Iran to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, President Trump has again threatened to destroy the country's civilian infrastructure.
And also in today's programme, as resident doctors in England take to the picket line for the 15th strike in 3 years, we'll hear from both the BMA and from the Health Secretary for England, Wes Streeting.
My father does not like waiting in queues. A queue, to him, means a man being denied the right to be where he wants to be at a time of his own choosing, which is at the front now.
The poet and life writer behind the best-selling And When Did You Last See Your Father gives his top tips for budding memoirists and...
3 cheers for Pooh, for who, for Pooh, why what did he do? I thought you knew, he saved his friend from a wetting.
Charles Brandreth on his new Winnie the Pooh poetry competition. The BBC News read this morning by Caroline Nichols.
The crew of NASA's Artemis II mission are beginning their journey home to Earth after travelling around the moon. They voyaged more than 252,000 miles into space, further than any human has gone before. As they passed around the far side of the moon, the four astronauts on board the Orion spacecraft lost contact with ground control in a planned communications blackout. Our science editor, Rebecca Morell, sent this report from Johnson Space Center in Houston.
A close encounter with the moon, and a view that humans haven't witnessed for more than 50 years. As the four astronauts voyaged onwards, they named some of the moon's features, a crater now called Integrity after their spacecraft, and another named after Artemis commander Reid Wiseman's late wife Carol. During the flyby, the constant contact with Mission Control was broken for a tense 40 minutes when the signal from their spacecraft was blocked by the moon itself. Then relief, as their link with Earth was re-established. And if these close-up views weren't enough, the astronauts had one more celestial treat, a solar eclipse that was just for them, as the sun vanished behind the moon, its outer atmosphere glowing in the darkness of space.
After the Artemis crew emerged from behind the moon and regained contact with ground control, they were spoken to directly by President Trump, who praised them for their achievements.
You really are modern-day pioneers. Your mission paves the way for America's return to the lunar surface very soon. This time we won't just leave footprints, we'll establish a permanent presence on the moon, and we'll push on to Mars.
President Trump has repeated his threat to destroy civilian infrastructure in Iran tonight if the country doesn't agree to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. He said he was not worried about warnings that attacking civilian targets could be a war crime. Our North America editor Sarah Smith reports from Washington.
Donald Trump has threatened to target Iran's bridges and power plants in a massive attack if the country does not meet his imminent deadline for agreeing to a deal. He's demanding that any agreement includes Iran reopening international shipping lanes in the Strait of Hormuz. The two sides are engaged in negotiations but appear to be far apart. Iran has rejected any proposal that includes a temporary ceasefire, demanding a complete end to hostilities instead. In over 5 weeks of this conflict, other deadlines imposed by Donald Trump have come and gone, but he said it was highly unlikely he would extend his deadline this time.
Israel says it's carried out another wave of strikes across Iran, including in the capital, Tehran. Explosions have also been reported in the city of Karaj. In the Gulf, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia and Bahrain have faced further missile strikes from Iran, triggering their air defence systems. A six-day strike by tens of thousands of resident doctors in England will begin in the next hour. It's their 15th walkout since March 2023 and one of the longest since the start of the dispute about pay and jobs. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
Health leaders say that working around this strike will be challenging as it comes straight after the bank holiday weekend when some community services are closed and hospitals have been under more pressure. They say with some staff booking leave, it's been harder to plan and fill rotas. But with senior doctors moved to cover emergency departments, NHS England says urgent care will continue as normal. It also says that 95% of planned treatment and operations will go ahead, though this will still mean thousands of postponements.
The managing director of a music festival in London has defended the decision to choose Kanye West as a headliner, despite his anti-Semitic comments. The American rapper has previously sold swastika T-shirts and released a song praising Adolf Hitler. He's since apologised and blamed his bipolar disorder. Melvin Benn, who runs Wireless Festival, encouraged people to offer Kanye West forgiveness. Reform UK says if it wins the next general election, it'll stop issuing visas to citizens of countries that demand reparations from the UK for its role in the slave trade. The party said such nations were ignoring the fact that Britain made huge sacrifices to be the first major power to outlaw slavery. Our political correspondent Damien Grammaticus reports.
Britain was one of the leading nations involved in the slave trade before abolishing the practice in the early 1800s. In recent years, a number of Caribbean countries have said they want to seek reparatory justice. Reform UK's Home Affairs spokesperson Zia Yusuf said that his party would stop issuing new visas to nationals of any state that formally demanded reparations. Sir Keir Starmer had indicated the UK would not discuss reparations, but could talk about helping countries with challenges they were facing right now. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, has said the UK should not pay compensation for a practice it helped end.
One of Australia's most decorated soldiers has been arrested for allegedly murdering unarmed prisoners while serving in Afghanistan. Ben Robert Smith is accused of shooting four unarmed Afghans and of ordering others to shoot people not engaged in hostilities. He's denied any wrongdoing. The price of stamps goes up today. The cost of posting a first-class letter is rising by 10 pence to £1.80. A second-class stamp is increasing by 4 pence to 91 pence. Royal Mail says the price increases are necessary because fewer letters are being sent, while the number of addresses is increasing. Here's our business correspondent, Jonathan Josephs.
Royal Mail is under growing pressure on several fronts, but to try to ease the financial strain of its obligation to deliver letters across the UK 6 days a week, it's putting stamp prices up. Many businesses and consumers are unhappy the increase is going ahead despite the company's failure to hit performance targets. Just 77% of first-class letters are being delivered within one working day, against a target of 93%. Royal Mail's owner admitted to Parliament last month that the service wasn't perfect, but said he had a plan to fix the situation.
Jonathan Josephs reporting.
Thank you, Caroline. It's 8 minutes past six. Let's check what the weather's got in store today with Darren Batt. Morning, Darren.
Good morning, Anna. Well, today is going to be the warmest day of the year so far, but it could be warmer still tomorrow across some parts of the UK. As far as today's concerned, though, it's going to be dry and sunny for many of us. The only changes are coming into Northern Ireland, where we'll see more cloud arriving during the afternoon, and some of that cloud will push into the far west of Scotland, and it brings with it the risk late in the day of one or two showers. Otherwise, it will be dry. It's going to be warmer than it was yesterday and over the bank holiday weekend. We're looking at temperatures in Scotland to reach 19 or 20 Celsius. In Northern Ireland, because of the cloud coming in, it'll be around about 15 degrees. And in Wales, 21 or 22 Celsius. This is where we'll see the highest temperatures today. England, though, will be around 19 to 21 degrees, a little bit cooler around some North Sea coast. There is a south to southeasterly breeze today, and we've got pollen levels very high across England and Wales and high for Scotland and Northern Ireland. With the cloud across Northern Ireland, that's going to be pushing into Scotland overnight. Could bring one or two showers into Scotland. Those will tend to clear away tomorrow morning. And the cloud in Scotland and Northern Ireland will gradually break up in the afternoon. Temperatures are going to be nearer 16 degrees. The higher temperatures will be across England and Wales tomorrow, where the winds are going to be a lot lighter, actually. And for the most part, it will be dry and sunny as well. The focus of the highest temperatures tomorrow, more likely across the Midlands, East Anglia in the southeast of England, with temperatures here reaching 24 Celsius.
Thank you very much, Darren. Now, it has been a night where history was made.
Yeah, from the cabin of integrity here, as we surpass the furthest distance humans have ever travelled from planet Earth, we do so in honouring the extraordinary efforts and feats of our predecessors in human space exploration. We will continue our journey even further into space before Mother Earth succeeds in pulling us back to everything that we hold dear. But we most importantly choose this moment to challenge this generation and in the next to make sure this record is not long lived.
Well, that was the moment that man travelled further than ever before. And then soon after, the next milestone, just before midnight, UK time, when for the first time in more than 50 years, there were humans who were completely unreachable by anyone on Earth.
And to all of you down there on Earth and around Earth, we love you from the moon.
Houston copies. We'll see you on the other side.
And a little more than 40 minutes of anxious breath holding in Houston followed before contact was restored.
Houston, Integrity, comm check.
Integrity, we have you loud and clear. Hummy.
Houston, we have you the same, and it is so great to hear from Earth again.
The crew spent much of the night recording pen portraits of what they'd seen, including this description from Artemis pilot Victor Glover of the Terminator. That is the dividing line between the illuminated and the dark hemispheres of the moon.
There's just so much magic in the Terminator. The islands of light, the valleys, the what look like black holes. You'd fall straight to the center of the moon if you stepped in some of those. It's just so visually captivating that the Terminator is the most striking thing that I've seen so far.
And there was one more striking sight for Victor Glover to record overnight, a spectacular solar eclipse.
It is bright, and the Earth shine is very distinct, and it creates quite an impressive visual illusion. Wow, it's amazing.
The crew went on to describe the corona as being similar to baby hair as the sun's light intensifies. Well, now the mission is on its way home, due to land back on Earth in the early hours of Saturday morning with a splashdown in the Pacific Ocean. And through the programme this morning, we will bring you reaction to those history-making overnight achievements, including from NASA's head of science, a British scientist, at 10 past eight.
And at 12 minutes past six, the papers, many of them lead with what's going on the moon, or at least around the moon. We saw the whole of the moon, the Sun's headline on the achievement of the Artemis II mission. A reference, it says here, to the hit song by the Waterboys. You probably know that already, don't you? The paper calls the mission a giant leap into history. The Guardian describes how the four astronauts dimmed the lights in their capsule, positioned themselves by windows in readiness for setting the distance record before hugging each other in celebration.
According to the Financial Times this morning, President Trump has talked up progress during indirect talks with Iran while doubling down on his threat to hit power plants and bridges there. The Daily Telegraph says negotiators, among them the Vice President J.D. Vance, are making a final push for peace. The Guardian's headline quotes President Trump, who said Iran could be taken in one night. The Eye reports that the UK won't allow Mr. Trump access to British bases to attack Iranian infrastructure.
More on all of that in just a second or two's time. The Daily Express and the Mail lead on the strike by resident doctors in England, with the latter among several papers estimating that the industrial action over the past 3 years has cost the health service more than £3 billion. The Times quotes the head of NHS England saying they won't let the BMA torpedo the very real progress made in improving care for patients. The BMA say the government's reluctance to reach a settlement is a political choice.
Sarah Ferguson has said she will never again travel to the United States due to rising pressure for her to testify to lawmakers about Jeffrey Epstein, according to the Daily Mirror. The report quotes an unnamed source who says Ms Ferguson is deeply worried about the reaction if she did visit the country. The paper has contacted the former Duchess of York for comment.
And the Daily Mail says King's College London has been accused of dumbing down by changing how it assesses students. The paper says traditional exams have been scrapped to be more inclusive. The university claims its standards are as high as ever.
It is 14 minutes past six.
Donald Trump is still threatening, though he's also suggesting that talks are going on with Iran. Let us turn to Daniel DeSimone, our correspondent in Jerusalem, to find out what the Israelis are making of all of this. Daniel, first question, I suppose, is the extent to which the Israelis would be on board if Donald Trump were to attack in a widespread way civilian infrastructure.
Well, here in Israel, President Benjamin Netanyahu is always very keen to publicly show that he's at one with Donald Trump. He calls him his friend. And in that sense, there seems to be a complete alliance in terms of how this war is being conducted. And if you look over the last few days, the Israelis have increasingly been striking infrastructure in Iran. They've been striking petrochemical infrastructure. They were striking steel-making infrastructure last week. And overnight, again, there were airstrikes in Iran, a wave of airstrikes, according to the Israeli military. And again, there was reference to striking infrastructure. So I think there's certainly support in the Israeli government for what Donald Trump is proposing to do. So, and the threat to target civilian infrastructure, which Donald Trump is making, and he's brushing off questions about this being a threat to commit war crimes. The UN is saying that there's already a real harm to civilian infrastructure in Iran, including homes, schools and health facilities. And they're saying strikes on critical infrastructure have already disrupted basic services, including electricity, water and telecommunications. So there's already an impact, according to the UN, on infrastructure. The threat of it, the threat that is being made, is of even greater damage by Donald Trump.
And talking of threats to the civilians, what is happening at the moment inside Israel? Is Iran still hitting Israel, and with what effect?
Well, there are still missiles being fired towards Israel, and that's happening every day. There's alerts every day. Some parts of the country, there are more alerts. I'm in Jerusalem. There wasn't an alert overnight here. There were yesterday. But that sort of shows that the Iranian government, the military, is still able to pose a threat. That's weeks into this war. We're heading to the sixth week of this war. And I think there's a sense that there was a real underestimation by the Israeli leadership, by the American leadership, about how this war could go on. And certainly some of Donald Trump's comments show that he seems a bit bewildered by the fact that this is still happening and that the Iranian military is still fighting. And according to their objectives, the Israeli and US governments, they won't have achieved their objectives until the Iranian threat is removed. And so I think that as long as Iran is able to fire missiles, it's hard to see how they can claim their objectives have been met.
Daniel DeSimone in Jerusalem. Thank you.
Still having an impact on the global economy as well. The head of America's biggest bank has warned that the war in Iran could push interest rates higher than expected. Sean Farrington's got more on that and the rest of the morning's business news as well. Hello, Sean.
Hi, Anna. Yeah, Jamie Dimon is the chief executive of JP Morgan. And in his annual letter to shareholders, he said the world faces the potential for significant ongoing oil and commodity price shocks, along with the reshaping of global supply chains as well. Tinika Fricke is a senior fund manager at W1M. Tinika, good morning.
Good morning.
This use of the word ongoing, is that becoming a bigger concern? Whatever happens with deadlines tonight, future deadlines that Donald Trump might talk about?
Yes, because particularly, I mean, for oil flows could potentially start coming through the Strait of Hormuz a bit quicker than expected, but they will take time to reach their destination. But for some other commodities like liquid natural gas, for example, facilities have been turned off, so it will take 3 to 4 months to get them back online. So there's a real lag impact, and then, as I suggested, some countries will probably want to get their power from different sources, so we will get a rejuggling of supply chains. So it will take time. So that will will create inflationary pressures. It's not something that central banks can do something about, but it will feed through the food chain, through plastic packaging, through petrol at the pump, etc. And then governments will need to raise more money. I mean, the US has obviously spent a lot on the war, will want to increase their defense budget. So that means that sort of long-term interest rates will go higher as governments need to borrow more.
Right, so not just the fact that individual regions and countries will be dealing with potentially higher inflation. It's the, and as we've heard, the concerns here in the UK, if inflation is going to be higher than previously expected, then it might not mean interest rates will be as low as previously thought, but it's that the borrowing issues as well.
That's right. It's a whole complex of situations, which means that you know, you've got your base rates that you get on your cash accounts, and they're going to stay higher for longer. But if you want a mortgage, for example, which is priced off sort of, it's sort of 2 to 5 years, it's very sensitive to how much borrowing governments are expected to make.
And just looking at the commodity markets this morning, and even, you know, what is happening on the Strait of Hormuz, it was interesting, you know, reading again this morning that, you know, some countries around the world have managed to get deals with Iran so that their ships can use that shipping route. So it's not fully closed. It seems like the Philippines are the latest one, the latest country to have agreed with Iran to allow some oil, some energy through, because they rely so much on energy from the Gulf. Yet, Brent crude oil up above $111 a barrel.
Yeah, but that's the thing. The fact that a ship can go through is great, but at what price, right? Because certainly just insurance for a ship, for example, has gone up a lot, and lots of other countries are also looking to have anything. So it kind of goes to the highest bidder. So it's great that there's some coming through, but it's coming at a higher cost, and that's why Brent is $111 per barrel, whereas last year we were averaged $69. So it's a big difference.
Interesting seeing that one Japanese vessel that managed to pass through the strait didn't comment on whether any tolls were paid and how the crew actually secured that safe passage. So, yes, we'll see exactly what all of that means. Tinica, thank you. Tinica Fricke, their senior fund manager at W1M. Something else that Jamie Dimon was talking about in his letter to shareholders is something he's raised before, the issue of private credit. And he's voiced again his worries about weakening lending standards in that market of private credit. He says losses in what is this largely unregulated area of non-bank loans could be higher than expected. He didn't think, though, that there was necessarily a systemic risk around all of this. Peter Hahn is Emeritus Professor of Finance and Banking and former advisor on regulation to the Bank of England. Peter, morning. Just first up, explain what you are talking about when we speak about private credit.
Okay, so private credit, Sean, you can make a loan, a corporation can make a loan, funds can make a loan, obviously banks and insurance companies. Banks and insurance companies are regulated, they're overseen by supervisors as to what risks they're taking. What we're talking about is the market that isn't regulated, as you just mentioned, and that's mostly through funds and corporations that are making loans. Now, when Jamie Dimon is talking, what I think he's talking about, because I didn't speak to him, is that some people will make those loans well and some won't, right? Because they're ambitious, they want to make more loans. And so as they strive to increase their business, they may have lowered their standards, less what we call covenants on the loans, easy terms to pay back, which can be extended. So they're adding risk in the system. But can it add systemic risk? I wouldn't agree with them.
You wouldn't. So this idea of systemic risk, why does that matter? What's the difference between this filtering out into other parts of people's households, businesses, finances, and it just actually being an issue with this one part of the market?
Well, the issues, there's a couple of them. One is that, you know, where does it touch? So there's probably a little bit in some pension funds. It's probably not enough to get worried about, but it's probably there in many ways. But it's also that banks who are regulated lend to the companies that are providing these loans, and we're getting more information on that. But probably the one that I think raises the most concern is if there's a shock, like we've had some recent large losses in companies that pop up, which I think he's made reference to, and if those companies making this largely growing supply of loans withdraw from it, they see risk. So all of a sudden, you know, you see some losses. Players who are making loans say, I think we'll hold off for a while and see what happens.
Right.
It's that hold off effect that means that money is now going to be tighter. Money's not going to be as easily forthcoming. And for businesses that depend on these loans, that can be quite a shock.
And yesterday we had this latest fund that does this kind of thing, this private credit fund managed by Barings, is the latest one to stop the amount investors can withdraw out of that fund. So they've limited it to 5%. There's been a few of these. Does that signify anything particular to you?
You bet, because it's obviously that fund is unlikely to be making new loans, isn't it, if they're worried about people taking their money out. So I think when you come to loans, we have to think about it quite differently. You know, shares of stock, shares of BP or Shell, they're what we call homogeneous, right? They're the same. Everybody can trade them. But loans are heterogeneous. Every loan is different. Even the same company can have a mortgage loan, a secured loan, or an unsecured loan, and one that has this and that. So highly illiquid. That
right.
means when you want to sell them, you have trouble selling them, getting a price. And ultimately, Jamie Dimon's comments are that it's a private market. That means information is poor. It's not like a public market where there's trading.
Yeah, and we've actually heard lately, you know, on this program that actually, you know, more data might be one way to alleviate fears. Peter, we're going to have to wrap it there. Thank you for your time. Peter Hahn there, Emeritus Professor of Finance and Banking. Right, let's go to the car industry. Some latest numbers out on that crucial month of March. 23% of car registrations last month were for electric vehicles, still some way short of government targets for this year of 33%. Mike Hawes is Chief Executive of the Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders, represents the industry. Mike, morning. Let's just reflect on what you've learned from this month. Often the busiest month of the year. New number plates. What can you tell us?
Absolutely. New number plate. It is always the busiest month of the year. Market's up about 6.5%, which is great. Of course, a lot of people who buy in March order ahead of that. So, you know, if you like, you know, what you've been talking about there about the impact on rising fuel prices, consumer confidence won't really play through until later and into this month, really. So very good news, but to a certain extent, you're looking in the rear vision mirror.
Maybe, but does it tell us that something's there in the economy if things do manage to settle down globally?
I think so, because, you know, this is 6.5% is significant growth. That, you know, is invariably, you know, buying a new car, you've got to be confident to do that. So that is something, a bellwether of consumer confidence. We hope that sustains. Increasing numbers of EVs, fantastic. Not where we want to be, because we have a mandated target, not of, you know, 22-23%, as you described, but 33%. We need to make up that gap.
What will happen to car companies if the rate at which they're selling electric vehicles stays around this level for 2026 and they miss that target by that much?
Well, they've got about three choices. Number one is you'll pay a fine, and a significant one at that, about £12,000 per vehicle. Secondly, the other option for compliance is to buy a credit. That's buying off a brand which will probably have 100% EVs. No one really wants to do that because you're giving money to your competitors. The third option is, as you go through the year, more and more incentives, which are already at high, incredibly high levels, have to go on the vehicle. But I think it's becoming unaffordable. So that's why we are asking the government to review this regulation, because clearly it is unsustainable. It is far in ambition higher than when it was set, and the level of expectations for the market were much higher than they've turned out to be.
Does that impact how customers behave? If they get a sense that actually electric vehicles are going to be cheaper in the future than they are right now, that they wait until that moment?
And invariably, you'll do that because technology over time invariably does come down in price. But you know, the level of incentives that are there at the moment, we've been saying for some time, you can't sustain this forever because, you know, they're at a level, you know, over twice what it would be on a petrol or diesel car. And these are on vehicles that are incredibly low, if any, margin. So from a economic viability point of view for the companies, you can't do this forever. So this is great news at the moment, but there are concerns about the ability over the course of the year to meet these targets.
Mike, thank you for your time. Mike Hawes there from the car industry.
Sean, thank you. It is 28 minutes past six. Here is Cathy with the sport.
Morning. Thank you very much. Coventry City are just 4 points away from a return to top flight football after a goalless draw with Hull City last night. Frank Lampard's side are 12 points clear at the top of the Championship as they aim for promotion back to the Premier League after 25 years. Lincoln City have been promoted to the Championship and will play second tier football next season for the first time since 1961. A 2-1 win over Reading secured a victory for Michael Scabala's side.
I mention the history to the lads all the time, so they're an excellent group, they work so hard, and you can see the fans today, look at this, the club is so connected, it's so driven, you know, we're a smaller club, we don't have the massive resources, but we believe, and when you have belief, you have good players, you have good staff, and you have a good plan, anything can happen, and it has.
Manchester City will face Chelsea in the semi-finals of the Women's FA Cup after beating Birmingham City 1-0. Chelsea defeated Spurs 2-1. Liverpool face Brighton in the final four after Brighton knocked 14-time winners Arsenal out of the Women's FA Cup. And Arsenal face Sporting in Lisbon tonight in the quarter-finals of the Men's Champions League. Declan Rice and Gabriel have trained after recent doubts over their fitness. There's commentary on 5 Live from 8 p.m. while Bayern Munich are waiting on the fitness of the England captain Harry Kane for their quarter-final against Real Madrid. Golf's Masters starts on Thursday, and after finishing in second place to Rory McIlroy in an emotional playoff in last year's tournament, England's Justin Rose is aware that he is many fans' sentimental favourite to win this year.
A lot of people are wishing me well or thinking it's going to be my year or whatever, you know, just based around sentiment, you know what I mean? So I'm going to have to manage that a little bit this week. And, you know, that's going to be a part of my week this week for sure, is people remembering what happened last year. So that's fine. But, you know, I've got to kind of like be aware of that, be ready for that. And I've got to have my own narrative and not like kind of buy into everyone else's narrative.
Sir Craig Reedy, the former chair of the British Olympic Association and president of the World Anti-Doping Agency, has died at the age of 84. Reedy chaired the BOA between 1992 and 2005. As BOA chair, he was part of London's successful bid for the 2012 Olympic and Paralympic Games. And at the start of the clay court section of the tennis season, Great Britain's Katie Bolter lost in the first round of Austria's Linz Open, defeated by the world number 87, Romania's Elena Gabriela Rusa. Cameron Norrie has had a more positive start on clay, winning his first round match at the Monte Carlo Masters. Norrie faces the world number 6, Alex de Minaur, in the second round this afternoon.
Thank you, Cathy. Let's look ahead to this weekend on Radio 4.
I had to fight, and I had to bring my sisters with me.
Brand new drama from Amelia Bullmore, inspired by real events.
My congregation was under threat of dispersal. We were being betrayed and we were being victimised.
A community of nuns fighting to save their order any way they can.
A nun can't sell a convent.
We can, in theory, with a unanimous vote.
They sold the convent for about 1.3 million euro.
Shirley Henderson stars in A Broken Order on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Saturday afternoon at 3.
Time now, 28 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on Radio 4. Anna Foster, Justin Webb and Caroline Nichols with the news.
NASA's Artemis 2 mission is on its way back to Earth. One of the four astronauts on board the Orion spacecraft said they'd seen sights that no human had ever seen as they travelled around the far side of the moon and witnessed a total solar eclipse. Shortly afterwards, the crew spoke to President Trump, who described them as true pioneers. President Trump has reiterated his threat to destroy bridges and power plants in Iran tonight if the country doesn't agree to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. He also said negotiations with Tehran were underway. A regional official has told the BBC that there are no signs of a breakthrough in the talks. In the next half an hour, resident doctors in England will start a 6-day strike in a dispute with the government about pay and job opportunities. The NHS says patients shouldn't put off seeking help as normal. Senior medics have been drafted in to provide cover in A&E departments, but it means some pre-planned appointments have been cancelled. The managing director of Wireless Festival in London has defended the decision to invite the American rapper Kanye West to perform at the event in July, despite his anti-Semitic comments. Melvin Benn encouraged people to offer Kanye West forgiveness. The performer has apologised and blamed his bipolar disorder after he sold swastika T-shirts and released a song praising Adolf Hitler. Reform UK says if it wins the next general election, it will stop issuing visas to citizens of countries that demand reparations from the UK for its role in the slave trade. The party said such nations were ignoring the fact that Britain made huge sacrifices to be the first major power to outlaw slavery. The price of a Royal Mail first-class stamp has increased by 10 pence to £1.80, while a second-class stamp has gone up by 4 pence to 91 pence. Royal Mail said the rise is necessary because fewer letters are being sent. But Citizens Advice says price increases should be tied to performance.
Thank you, Caroline. 26 minutes to 7. Now, the crew of Artemis 2 travelled around the far side of the moon overnight and went further away from Earth than any human in history. Rebecca Morell, our science editor, has been following developments from NASA's Mission Control in Houston, Texas. And it was, Rebecca, from a scientific point of view, a huge moment.
Yeah, I mean, it has been a really big day here at Mission Control in Houston. I mean, first of all, history being made when the astronauts broke the record by the Apollo 13 astronauts set in 1970, travelling further into space than any humans have ever been before. And then they just kept on going, eventually exceeding that record by about 4,000 miles. Then the astronauts closed in on the moon, and we haven't seen their images yet. They're waiting to be downlinked a quarter of a million miles away back to Earth. But one of their jobs was to actually record themselves saying what they were seeing on the lunar surface, sort of the perfect story for radio, actually. And they spoke about the colours popping out, you know, the subtle shades of green and blue and brown. They spoke about the textures they were seeing, the fact that younger craters seem to be much brighter than older craters. And then to top it all off, you know, if that wasn't enough, they had a celestial treat at the end. The trajectory of their spacecraft meant they were able to see a solar eclipse that was just for them, with the sun sliding behind the moon. So, yeah, it's been a very big day here for the science team, who are sort of waiting for those images to be downlinked and those descriptions too, because they're the things that really add context to the pictures. They bring them to life for the team.
Yeah, they are. And it's easy to forget at moments like this, when we're talking about the achievements of this particular mission, that actually this is just one step and they plan to go far further.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is their sort of America's first return to the moon in more than 50 years. I mean, other countries involved too. One of the astronauts is Canadian. Europe has been involved with building part of the spacecraft. But, you know, after this, they want to land on the moon, and that's scheduled for 2028, and then eventually build a base there. So the Apollo astronauts, NASA says, were sort of more about kind of getting to the moon, fleeting visits. This time they want to go there to stay. So for NASA, it does feel like this is just the start for them. But their timeline for getting back to the moon is extremely ambitious. And they have got China hot on their heels too, who are making fast progress with their moon plan. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. But it's been a very big step for the US Space Agency today with their return to the moon.
Yeah, it has. Rebecca, thank you. Rebecca Morell, our science editor. We'll hear more from her later, and from NASA's head of science as well at 10 past 8.
24 minutes to 7 is the time. Now the government's telling us that junior doctors, resident doctors as they're now called, are costing the health service billions of pounds with their strike action. The latest walkout begins in, 20 minutes or so time. Let's talk to Hugh Pym, our health editor, who is on the line. This summing up of the money is interesting, isn't it, Hugh, that it comes just as they're about to go on strike, and is 3 billion out of, an annual budget of 240 or so?
Yeah, exactly. 200 billion plus, certainly, just in England. I think what this calculation involves is taking quite a basic look at it and saying each strike, according to the government, costs around 250 to 300 million. Add up all the days, the 15 strikes so far, including this one, and you get to something like 3 billion. Those figures have never been properly interrogated because they cover the cost of extra overtime for consultants drafted into A&E and other areas of urgent care. Also, they assume that you've lost money as a hospital if you've had to postpone operations. You don't get the tariff that you would have got, but you will eventually pick that up. So I think it's a bit of a sort of crude analysis, but it does suggest that there is quite a lot of money that is needed each time there's a strike by trusts to actually to make things safe.
It's also over 3 years, isn't it, which is the period of the strike. So actually, it's not 200 million. It's more like 600 or 700 million that it's taken out of. I mean, is there any sign, do you think, this morning as this strike begins, that there is anywhere where the two sides can potentially meet and come together?
Well, that seems hard to actually discern, because they talked for nearly 3 months, starting the new year following the December strike, and there were indications they were making progress, and there was a bit of an assumption they were heading in a direction that would result in a resolution, you know, all those talks. But then they broke down, and of course we get differing accounts of what happened. The government is saying they made a very full deal with training posts and so on, although that's been removed from the table, as we know, with exam fees covered, with a pay increase that would have meant that resident doctors were 35% better off than 4 years ago. But the BMA saying, well, it was all going fine, but at the last minute, the government moved the goalposts and actually diluted the offer, spreading it over more years than had been assumed. So there are claims and counterclaims. I think Health Secretary Wes Streeting has said he's very disappointed, and he's urging patients to go into A&E and get care as needed. But the BMA are simply saying, well, we do want to talk, we do want a deal. It is going to involve some more pay, but let's get back round the table.
OK, and we'll hear from them and indeed from Wes Streeting during the course of the programme. Hugh Pym, thank you.
It's 21 minutes to seven. Reform UK says if any countries formally seek reparations from Britain for slavery, then if they make it to government, they would stop issuing new visas to nationals from those countries. Our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman, is with us. Morning, Henry.
Good morning.
So what more have they said?
Yeah, I mean, the question of reparations for the slave trade has bubbled up now and again over recent years. It was a big feature, for example, of the last Commonwealth Heads of Government Summit in 2024, which Sir Keir Starmer attended. And what Reform UK are saying, well, as it stands, the government's position is that it won't discuss reparations. They say that if they were in government, they would go further. Zia Yusuf, who's the party's Home Affairs spokesperson, said that the UK had made huge sacrifices to outlaw slavery. And if they were in government, as you say, they would stop issuing any new visas to nationals of any state that had formally demanded reparations from the UK. The party says this is a sign that a reform government would not allow Britain to be slapped around and ridiculed on the world stage. A Labour Party spokesperson says this is a desperate gimmick from reform that would do nothing to restore order and control to Britain's borders. And the Conservative Party's position as well is that the UK should not pay compensation for a practice, i.e. the slave trade, that it helped end.
And the government has an announcement on knife crime today, tackling knife crime. What will that entail?
Yes, yeah, actually various different announcements from the government on knife crime. Among them, that up to 250 schools identified as being in knife crime hotspots will get specialist training from the government. This is seen as a hyper-targeted scheme. They're using new technology developed by the Home Office, which will apparently pinpoint knife crime hotspots down to the nearest 10 square metres. And they say that technology will allow police to identify where knife crime is highest, particularly when children are commuting to school, and thereby determine which schools could benefit the most from this help. The measures would include things like mentoring for high-risk students and also chaperones on school routes. The Conservatives accuse the government in response of having a massive cheek. They say that in London, the government scrapped dedicated police officers in schools and that a Conservative government would go further and be tougher, while the Liberal Democrats say these measures alone won't be enough to end the plight of knife crime.
Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent. Thank you.
18 minutes to seven is the time. It is a weird fact that if you've been scammed online, the chances are that the scammers are in the Far East and possibly in the nation of Cambodia. The Cambodian government says it's going to eliminate the international scam business within its borders by the end of April after pressures from countries including China and the US. Scam compounds built by powerful local business figures run mainly by Chinese crime syndicates have proliferated right across Southeast Asia, defrauding people all around the world of billions of dollars. By some estimates, they account for half of the entire Cambodian economy. Our correspondent Jonathan Head was taken by the Thai military to a scam compound captured during Thailand's border war with Cambodia last year. A rare close-up glimpse of the lucrative and abusive business.
We are standing at the entrance to the casino complex. Located here.
At a now deserted crossing between Thailand and Cambodia, Rear Admiral Surasang Kongsiri describes what he's about to show us on the other side of the border gate.
Both sides of the casino complex has the scam centres.
The Thai military captured two casino complexes there from Cambodia last December. What they found was a warren of buildings where workers brought from all over the world had been running online fraud schemes.
We really didn't anticipate that we would find such a large-scale scam centre operating out of this facility.
So we're walking up inside. These are really big buildings, several stories high. There's just mess and rubbish everywhere. Bottles, beer, plates still with food encrusted in them. And there would have been, judging by the size of it, thousands of people working here. Every room has got its own reconstructed scenario to persuade victims to part with their savings. In this one, there are two very convincing looking Vietnamese police hats. You can see piles and piles of documents with lists of hundreds of phone numbers on them. These are all Vietnamese phone numbers, and there are so many of them, just so many. So this is a room full of makeshift booths with soundproof foam. There are perhaps eight chairs to a row that just a few months ago were packed with human beings. And there's a quite convincing backdrop from the Brazilian federal police. And judging by the Portuguese language here, this room was targeting Brazilian victims.
Every time we would hear a bomb, even the building sometimes would shake, would vibrate.
Later, we managed to contact Wilson, a young Ugandan man who was working in that scam compound when the fighting broke out. He's now in the Cambodian capital trying to get home. He described an unforgiving regime run by his Chinese bosses.
You're supposed to get someone who would deposit at least $5,000. Failure to do so, you are put into punishment. Some people were electrocuted.
After years of denying the problem, the Cambodian government has this year been raiding dozens of scam compounds in response to rising international pressure. Prime Minister Hun Manet wants the world to believe he's sincere.
The scam network, or we call the black economy, is destroying our honest economy. So this is the reason why we need to clean this out.
But the complex we saw, like so many others in Cambodia, wasn't owned by a shadowy criminal network, but by a prominent business figure with close ties to the ruling family. Jacob Sims, a transnational crime expert, believes there are good reasons for scepticism over the government's claim to be shutting the scam business down.
This is likely the largest industry in Cambodia's history, structurally embedded at the highest levels of Cambodia's political economy. The crackdowns are real, but they're tending to target low-level criminals. They're very unlikely to produce meaningful disruption.
Already there are reports of scam workers from closed compounds being moved to lower-profile locations in Cambodia to continue their fraud schemes. With no other industry offering such rich rewards, it will be hard for Cambodia's elite to give it up.
As Jonathan Head reporting, it's 13 minutes to 7 now. After weeks of US and Israeli attacks on Iran's military and defence infrastructure, what is the current status of its nuclear programme? Apparently obliterated, according to President Trump, during last summer's 12-day war, its continued existence was then given as one of the reasons to launch this new conflict. Well, Daria Dolzikova joins a senior research fellow with RUSI's Proliferation and Nuclear Policy programme. Daria, good morning.
Good morning.
We know it is difficult to assess at the moment. We know the International Atomic Energy Agency do not have inspectors in the country right now for obvious reasons. So what can we glean about the current state of the Iranian nuclear program?
Well, precisely as you said, it's quite difficult to get a proper assessment of what the state of the program is at the moment. We know what the program looked like before the June strikes, or certainly we had a much, much better idea of what it looks like. So prior to the June strikes, the assessment was that Iran had stockpiled sufficient fissile material, sufficient enriched uranium, and had enriched it to sufficient levels that it could produce enough fissile material for multiple nuclear weapons in under a week, and then more after that. So the assessment was that Iran hadn't actually made the decision to move forward with weaponization, and it takes a lot more than actually producing the fissile material to develop a nuclear weapon. But nevertheless, the concerns over Iran's potential to move towards weaponization if it decided to do so were very real. In June, a number of key facilities were struck. So a number of key enrichment sites were targeted, and a few other research centers that would have been important for the development of a nuclear weapon were targeted. So most of the damage to Iran's physical infrastructure for the development of nuclear weapons, if it decided to go that way, most of the damage will have been suffered back in June, would have been inflicted back in June. But obviously a number of the sites have been targeted in the last month as well. That would have, again, it's a bit hard to assess the damage of those strikes as well, but that would have set the program back a little bit more. Again, hard to say exactly how much. But I think the key question to be asking, in addition to what's happened to the physical infrastructure, is what has happened to Iran's strategic calculus and what has happened to its leadership and the decision-making centers that would be the ones that would be deciding whether or not Iran should actually move towards a nuclear weapon, whether it's actually, if that's the only deterrent that it feels it can now really use or trust to deter further attacks on its territory in the future.
There are these interesting suggestions swirling around that the US might try some sort of ground operation to actually take away, physically recover any enriched uranium that that still exists in Iran. What are the chances of something like that being successful?
Well, so I think we need to also be conscious of the fact that the U.S. administration will be considering a variety of options. You know, it's the responsibility of the U.S. intelligence community, of the military, to present the president with a wide menu of options. So we don't know how seriously they're actually considering a ground invasion for to secure the fissile material that I had mentioned. And if they decided to go ahead with something like that, it would be a very complicated operation. It wouldn't be impossible, certainly. The U.S. military and the special forces certainly would have been training for operations along these lines. The U.S. military has taken out highly enriched uranium at much higher levels in previous circumstances or in previous instances, but that was under very different circumstances. I'm thinking particular of Project Sapphire in Kazakhstan, but that was with a cooperative government. It took months to get that material out. We don't know how much of Iran's material is left. We don't know where it is exactly. We have an idea, but we don't know for sure. And this operation would presumably be happening under very difficult circumstances and in the middle of a war zone.
Yeah, so as with so much that's going on there at the moment, very difficult to predict, isn't it? Daria Dolzikova from RUSI, thank you.
It is 9 minutes to seven, as we've been hearing this morning. The government is accusing the resident doctors, used to be known as junior doctors, of costing the health service billions of pounds with their strikes, the latest of those strikes in England, beginning in just a few minutes' time. And Dr. Jack Fletcher, who chairs the BMA's Resident Doctors Committee, is here in the studio. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
$3 billion over 3 years, money that could have been spent on the health service and hasn't been.
So it's really disappointing to be sat here again about to start another round of industrial action, which was entirely avoidable. We spent several weeks in negotiations with the government, discussing with them a package to make progress on jobs to fix this absurd jobs crisis, where we are turning away tens of thousands of resident doctors every single year from jobs in our NHS at a time when the government is presiding over corridor care as a standard. We do feel like we've made progress in some areas. However, right at the last minute, the government chose to reduce the investment on the table around pay. They reduced it, and then they stretched it over a number of years. We gave them several opportunities to walk that back. They chose not to. We then felt like we had no choice but to call further industrial action, because what was left on the table would have represented likely real terms pay cuts going forward, and that's against the backdrop of a decade plus of pay rush.
Nonetheless, people, when they look at their morning papers this morning, and it's the front page of quite a few of them, will see you costing the health service £3 billion and think, number one, that's a lot of money. Number two, it's a waste.
So there's two things about that number. The first one is, by our maths net, we estimate that essentially the whole value of the lost pay that we faced in the last decade plus is worth about £1 billion net. Now, yes, that would be an ongoing cost, and nobody's asking for that money in one go. Nobody's asking for that lost value in one go overnight. We're asking for a credible journey back towards what doctors were paid and worth in 2008, and a resolution to the jobs
crisis. So roughly that's an equivalent cost there, because this £3 billion is over 3 years or so, which is how long the strikes have been going on. You're saying actually you could spend that same amount of money, roughly, as what it would cost to fund the pay award that you're asking for.
My predecessors made that argument in 2022 and then 2023, and the political choices of the government at the time and then the political choices of this government have meant more rounds of industrial action.
Okay, well, we'll put that to Wes Streeting when we talk to him in an hour or so's time. The other thing the government says, almost 95% of planned activity during the December strikes in hospitals actually went ahead. In other words, the strikes are costly, but they're not really achieving anything for you, and that workarounds are being found.
So it's interesting, the December industrial action was again avoidable. The reason we had to take action in December was because we sent a letter to the health secretary following our November action, and he didn't reply at all.
And but they're saying that action didn't work.
And therefore we felt like we had to take action, and actually that action brought the government to the table. So it's regrettable that we're in a situation where actually we feel like we have to take action to bring the government to the table. This time round it's even more disappointing because both sides were at the table talking constructively.
But how much planned activity this time round will not happen, do you believe? Because, I mean, they're saying most, I mean, the overwhelming majority, 95% of planned activity in hospitals happened during those strikes. Is that going to be the same, do you think, this time?
So it's really difficult to predict. I think what is worth remembering is the patients who are on the other end of this. And I'm genuinely very sorry for any patients. I've been reading about a number of patients who've had care postponed as a result of this industrial action. And I'm genuinely very, very sorry for that. However, in amongst those cases, I'm also reading that patients have had care moved several times previously without strike action to this month because we don't have enough specialists. We don't have enough GPs. And what we're saying is actually, the way out of this is to get round the negotiating table, as we were, for 8 or so weeks, talk constructively to get to a deal, to get us out of this,
but also
not by making
those
threats
things,
in the media to reduce the amount of jobs.
Well, the government
would
say, and I'm sure Wes Streeting is going to say in an hour's time, also, but when they come up with something, put it to your members, which you haven't done.
So we hear this quite a lot, and the government were absolutely convinced, as well as a number of people in the sort of media in December, they were absolutely convinced that the offer in December was going to be overwhelmingly accepted by members. We hear this quite a lot, and actually it was resoundingly rejected in 72 hours. 83% of members then rejected it. We are resident doctors. We all work as resident doctors who are elected to represent our colleagues on the Resident Doctors Committee. We didn't feel like the offer met the threshold to be able to go to members. We believe that members would have rejected it. We were challenged at the time in December. It was then the government were then proven wrong.
We have not proved them wrong again.
We've had the same challenge this time back. However, ultimately, we feel that we were making good progress towards a deal that was likely to be taken shape and potentially bring an end to this action. And right at the last minute, the government moved the goalposts.
Why don't you pay your own people at the BMA properly?
So I was stood on a picket line with our staff and colleagues a couple of weeks ago. I have absolutely no role in setting BMA staff pay in the same way that I've got absolutely no role in setting teachers' pay, nurses' pay. I think any profession, whether it be nurses, whether it be other colleagues in the NHS, whether it be teachers or whether it be BMA staff, who are looking at real terms pay cuts and real terms pay erosion, I think they have a credible case.
So you support them?
To take
just to be clear to people, they're on strike today, aren't they? Well, sorry, yesterday and today. They're getting a pay offer, but it's a pretty small pay offer. In other words, from your position as chair of the Resident Doctors Committee, you support those members of staff at the BMA who are on strike?
I think it's entirely reasonable for any group of staff who have faced real terms pay cuts for a number of years to seek to restore the value of that lost pay.
Dr. Jack Fletcher, Chairman of the BMA's Resident Doctors Committee, thank you. And as I say, we'll hear from Wes Streeting in an hour's time.
On BBC iPlayer, they're on a journey into the unknown.
On the race, we're definitely going to use our Skulls Charm.
A race of more than 12,000 kilometres.
You've got to give it all to win.
Margo!
What? Yay! Show a leg!
The further they go...
Where are we going?
I have no idea.
The closer they'll get.
Let's get in there and sign that book.
Brand new Race Across the World.
I don't think this place exists.
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
Let's check the weather with Darren Bett.
Thanks very much, Anna. Good morning. Well, most places are going to be dry and sunny today. It's going to warm up very quickly as well. The only changes are coming into the far west across Northern Ireland. We'll see more cloud arriving during the afternoon. That'll push into the far west of Scotland. And by the end of the day, there could be one or two showers as well. There is a south to southeasterly breeze today. A little brisk to begin with, but it will die down. That's bringing in the warmer air from the near continent. Temperatures are higher today than they will be than they were yesterday. In Northern Ireland, because of the cloud, it's going to be around 15 degrees. But in Scotland, in the sunshine, 19 or 20 Celsius. In England, 19 to 21 degrees today. A little bit cooler around some North Sea coast with the onshore breeze. But the highest temperatures today are going to be in Wales, 21 or 22 Celsius. However, you may well be aware of this already. If you're a hay fever sufferer, we've got some very high pollen levels today across England and Wales and also into parts of Scotland. In Scotland and Northern Ireland, though, overnight, we're going to find more cloud. There could be a few showers in Scotland overnight. Those will clear away tomorrow morning, and the cloud eventually breaking in Scotland and Northern Ireland. Temperatures typically 16 degrees, a little bit higher in eastern Scotland. But the highest temperatures will be across England and Wales tomorrow, where, again, it's going to be dry and sunny. The winds will be light, but the highest temperatures, more in the southeast of England, could reach 24 Celsius.
Darren, thank you very much for that. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Justin Webb.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Tuesday, the 7th of April. The headlines this morning: the astronauts on the Artemis 2 lunar mission are making their way back to Earth, having travelled deeper into space than any humans in history. President Trump has suggested the whole of Iran could be taken out, in his words, tonight if it doesn't meet his deadline for reopening the Strait of Hormuz. And resident doctors in England have just started their six-day strike in a long-running dispute about pay and jobs. We'll speak to the Health Secretary for England, Wes Streeting, before 8 o'clock.
Also coming up in this hour, why the director of the Wireless Festival has defended the decision to choose Kanye West as a headliner despite his anti-Semitic comments, and...
Three cheers for Pooh, for who, for Pooh? Why, what did he do? I thought you knew. He saved his friend from a wetting.
Charles Brandreth on his new Winnie the Pooh poetry competition. The BBC News is read this morning by Caroline Nichols.
The crew of NASA's Artemis 2 mission are beginning their journey home to Earth after travelling around the moon. In doing so, they voyaged more than 252,000 miles into space, further than any human has gone before. As they passed around the far side of the moon, the four astronauts on board the Orion spacecraft lost contact with ground control in a planned communications blackout. Our science editor, Rebecca Morell, sent this report from Johnson Space Center in Houston.
A close encounter with the moon, and a view that humans haven't witnessed for more than 50 years.
There are islands of terrain out there that are completely surrounded by darkness. Up to the north, there is a very nice double crater. It looks like a snowman.
Before they made the flyby, the Artemis astronauts made history.
Integrity crew, on April 15, 1970, during the Apollo 13 mission, three explorers set the record for the farthest distance humans have ever traveled from our home planet. Today, for all humanity, you're pushing beyond that frontier.
As the four astronauts voyaged onwards, they named some of the moon's features, a crater now called Integrity after their spacecraft, and another named after Artemis commander Reid Wiseman's late wife Carol, who died 6 years ago. During the flyby, the constant contact with mission control was broken for a tense 40 minutes when the signal from their spacecraft was blocked by the moon itself.
Houston, we have you the same, and it is so great to hear from Earth again.
Then relief, as their link with Earth was re-established. And if these close-up views weren't enough, the astronauts had one more celestial treat, a solar eclipse that was just for them, as the sun vanished behind the moon, its outer atmosphere glowing in the darkness of space.
President Trump has repeated his threat to destroy civilian infrastructure in Iran tonight if the country doesn't agree to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. He said he was not worried about warnings that attacking civilian targets could be a war crime. Our North America editor Sarah Smith reports from Washington.
Donald Trump has threatened to target Iran's bridges and power plants in a massive attack if the country does not meet his imminent deadline for agreeing to a deal. He's demanding that any agreement includes Iran reopening international shipping lanes in the Strait of Hormuz. The two sides are engaged in negotiations but appear to be far apart, with President Trump saying a 10-part plan put forward by Iran is not good enough. Iran has rejected any proposal that includes a temporary ceasefire, demanding a complete end to hostilities instead. In over 5 weeks of this conflict, other deadlines imposed by Donald Trump have come and gone. He's often threatened to bomb Iran back to the Stone Age and then extended his time frame. But he said it was highly unlikely he would extend his deadline this time.
The Israeli military has told people in Iran to avoid trains and railway lines. In a post on social media, it said that anyone failing to do so would be putting their life at risk. Israel has carried out a wave of strikes across Iran overnight, including in the capital Tehran. The United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia and Bahrain have also faced further missile strikes from Iran. A six-day strike by tens of thousands of resident doctors in England has just begun. It's their 15th walkout since March 2023 and one of the longest since the start of the dispute about pay and jobs. NHS bosses have told patients to seek care as normal during the strike. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
Health leaders say that working around this strike will be challenging as it comes straight after the bank holiday weekend when some community services are closed and hospitals have been under more pressure. They say with some staff booking leave, it's been harder to plan and fill rotas. But with senior doctors moved to cover emergency departments, NHS England says urgent care will continue as normal. It also says that 95% of planned treatment and operations will go ahead, though this will still mean thousands of postponements. The Health Secretary Wes Streeting said the strike was disappointing for patients and staff when a pay deal offering 35% more compared with 4 years ago was on the table. The doctors' union, the BMA, said ministers had watered down the pay offer just as a deal was taking shape.
The managing director of Wireless Festival in London has defended the decision to choose Kanye West as a headliner, encouraging people to offer the rapper forgiveness. Melvin Benn said the performer had made abhorrent comments about Jews, but that giving people a second chance was becoming a lost virtue. Our culture correspondent Noor Nanji reports.
In a statement, Melvin Benn said the festival was not giving West a platform to extol opinion of whatever nature, only to perform songs that are currently played on radio and streaming platforms and listened to and enjoyed by millions. His remarks come at a tricky moment for the festival. Its headline sponsor Pepsi, as well as the drinks giant Diageo and the brewing company behind Budweiser, AB InBev, have all withdrawn their support. It's also emerged that the online payment platform, PayPal, will not allow its branding to be used in promotional materials. Kanye West, now known as Ye, issued an apology for his anti-Semitic comments in January, attributing them to his bipolar disorder. His representatives have been approached for comment.
Reform UK says if it wins the next general election, it will stop issuing visas to citizens of countries that demand reparations from the UK for its role in the slave trade. The party said such nations were ignoring the fact that Britain made huge sacrifices to be the first major power to outlaw slavery. Our political correspondent Damien Grammaticus reports.
Britain was one of the leading nations involved in the slave trade, transporting an estimated 3 million Africans across the Atlantic before abolishing the practice in the early 1800s. In recent years, a number of Caribbean countries have said they want to seek reparatory justice for the legacy of damaged lives, including an apology, help with development, and possible compensation. Reform UK's Home Affairs spokesperson Zia Yusuf said the UK had made huge sacrifices to outlaw slavery, and if in government, his party would stop issuing new visas to nationals of any state that formally demanded reparations. Sir Keir Starmer has said slavery was abhorrent and indicated the UK would not discuss reparations but could talk about helping countries with challenges they were facing right now. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, has said the UK should not pay compensation for a practice it helped end.
Australia's most decorated living soldier has been arrested for allegedly murdering unarmed prisoners while serving in Afghanistan. Ben Robert Smith, a former member of the Special Air Service Regiment, is accused of shooting four unarmed Afghans and of ordering others to shoot people not engaged in hostilities. He's denied any wrongdoing. The price of stamps goes up today. The cost of posting a first-class letter is rising by 10 pence to £1.80. A second-class stamp is increasing by 4 pence to 91 pence. Royal Mail says the price increases are necessary because fewer letters are being sent, while the number of addresses is increasing. Here's our business correspondent, Jonathan Josephs.
Royal Mail is under growing pressure on several fronts, but to try to ease the financial strain of its obligation to deliver letters across the UK 6 days a week, it's putting stamp prices up. Many businesses and consumers are unhappy the increase is going ahead despite the company's failure to hit performance targets. Just 77% of first-class letters are being delivered within one working day, against a target of 93%. From next month, business account holders also face some higher charges because the Iran war has increased the cost of energy. Royal Mail's owner admitted to Parliament last month that the service wasn't perfect, but said he had a plan to fix the situation.
Jonathan Josephs reporting.
Thank you, Caroline. It's 9 minutes past seven. History was made overnight.
Houston, integrity, comm check.
Integrity, we have you loud and clear. How many?
Houston, we have you the same, and it is so great to hear from Earth again.
That was the moment in the early hours of this morning when the crew of Artemis II returned from the far side of the moon, having looped successfully around it, and in doing so, travelled further out into space and away from the Earth than any humans have done before. For 40 minutes, they were out of contact with mission control, the communications blocked by the moon itself. And once they were back in touch with home, President Trump called to offer his congratulations.
I'd like to ask, what was your feeling when you had no communication, zero communication, all of a sudden it was cut off by, obviously, your very special location? What was your feeling when you had no communication? A little bit different, perhaps.
I said a little prayer, but then I had to keep rolling. I was actually recording scientific observations of the far side of the moon. You know, that is actually the time when we were the farthest and the closest to the moon. And so we were really able to make some of our most detailed observations of the far side of the moon up close. And so we were busy up here working really hard. And I must say, it was actually quite nice.
Sure it was. That was Artemis Commander Reid Wiseman talking to President Trump. Well, Dr. Megan Christian joins us, a reserve astronaut with the European Space Agency. Good morning.
Good morning.
Considering that it was so many decades ago that we first went to the moon, how much more difficult was achieving what we've seen in the last few hours?
Well, you know, things have really changed over the past 50 years or so. Technology has changed. We've taken leaps and bounds, and that's really had to be shown through space travel as well. So it was really like starting from scratch. But even though, you know, people have been there before, this was a truly historic moment because these four astronauts were perfectly poised between past and future, witnessing the evidence of the history of the solar system, witnessing the evidence of our past exploration with the sites of Apollo 12 and 14, but also imagining the future of human space exploration. They're the first four of our generation who could really dream of what it would be like to climb into a lunar crater or set up a lunar base at the South Pole, because they've seen the changing colours and the landscapes with their own eyes.
Yeah, it's something which you're hoping to do in the future. How does your training prepare you for those tricky moments, the time when you've got no communication with Earth, for example?
The training is all about knowing exactly what's going to happen in any given moment. So you prepare generally in the basic training, which is what I'm doing at the moment. But then you get really into detail during the mission-specific training. So these astronauts have been through simulation after simulation, knowing exactly what's going to happen in any given moment. And so they are completely prepared for it. And I think you heard there that they were ready for it. They knew what was happening, and they were probably, pleased to have a bit of time to really focus on their tasks and get through those observations. I mean, we talk about how it will be nerve-wracking to be out of communications. But for me, if I were in their shoes, I think the most nerve-wracking thing would be making sure that I got all those observations done and done well.
Yes, because you don't get much of a window to do them, do you? What are we going to learn from what they witnessed?
So we're going to see images of the far side of the moon taken with human eyes that, you know, we just haven't been able to capture before. These astronauts have been further than any human has been before, which means that they could capture images of the far side of the moon, all of the far side of the moon at once. But more than that, this is a test flight. This is preparing us for the future of exploration. This is preparing us for future landing sites, for example, knowing where a good place to land will be as we go forward into the future Artemis missions, because this time we're not just going to the moon, we're going there to stay.
Yeah, and that shows the complexity of it, really, because this Artemis mission has been delayed various times over the years. And as you say, in many ways, it's still an early point for Artemis, because the plan is to be on the moon and then to use that to go even further.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, every year, millions of people visit places on Earth, like the Great Pyramids, not because they can't view them in exquisite detail in photos or in 3D renderings, but because they want to experience them in person and feel the resonance of an ancient culture. And these astronauts are doing that. When they get back to Earth, they'll be able to look back at the moon and say, I've been there.
Exactly, which is something that, you know, potentially in the future, many more people will be able to say, although at the moment, there's still a limited number of you who are doing that kind of training, isn't there?
Yes, for now it's still unfortunately limited to a very small group of people. As a reserve myself, there are no guarantees that I will get to space. But, you know, with this, the increasing cadence of the Artemis missions, with more commercial missions happening to low Earth orbit, things are looking hopeful. And I think that within the next 50 years, we will have many, many more people going to space.
Yeah, and hopefully we'll speak to you again about your experience in space one day. Dr. Megan Christian, thank you for joining us from the European Space Agency.
7:15 is the time. What is Donald Trump going to do next? Every bridge in Iran will be decimated, he says, if a deal is not made with the Iranian leadership by tonight. Every power plant out of business, burning, exploding, never to be used again, as he put it. The actual deadline is 1 a.m. our time on Wednesday. The Israeli army, by the way, in the last hour or so, has been telling Iranian civilians not to take trains until this evening for their own safety. Sarah Smith, our North America editor, has been listening to the president at his news conference as he prepares to make a momentous decision.
The threats Donald Trump is making against Iran are the most aggressive yet. Now, I mean, there have been many times up until now when we have heard him set a deadline and then back down from it, extend his time frame. But he has never threatened this kind of destruction against Iran before. He said the entire country could be taken out in one night, and that night could be tomorrow, saying that in just 4 hours, he claims, the US could destroy pretty much all of Iran's civilian infrastructure of bridges, power plants, and more. And of course, if he were to do that, that could constitute a war crime, but he shrugged off questions about that and sounded, anyway, as though he was determined to press ahead and stick to this deadline that he has set. But as I say, he has claimed that before.
And if he does go ahead with that threatened action, are there political consequences in the US for him?
The political bind he finds himself in the US has got to be a major part of his thinking at the moment. And we got a clue into that when he said earlier on Monday that if it was up to him, he would like to take all the oil in Iran, but he knows that the American people wouldn't support such a move. They would like to see us come home, he said. So that was very clear. He knows that there is political pressure from voters inside America to wrap this conflict up, to not drag this out any further. So he's obviously feeling that as he is trying to create the circumstances either in which he can force Iran to make a deal agreeable to him, including reopening the Straits of Hormuz, or deliver a blow to Iran that maybe could allow him to declare victory and get out.
It's fascinating, isn't it, Sarah, the extent to which J.D. Vance is now being mentioned by the White House, by others, as a potential involvement in talks with Iran, but also just the fact that his name is now being mentioned, whereas it wasn't at all at first, was it?
Yeah, because J.D. Vance, the vice president, is known to be sceptical about the wisdom of this war. And when he has spoken out publicly about it, he hasn't sounded terribly enthusiastic. But he's now deeply embroiled in trying to end it. He is part of the negotiations that are going on indirectly with Iran, being coordinated by Pakistan. It is the president's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, who was in the White House with him on Monday, and the vice president, J.D. Vance, who are speaking on behalf of the United States. But as we understand it, those talks do not look particularly optimistic at the moment. We have a 10-point plan that was put forward by Iran has described as not good enough from Donald Trump. And we know also that Iran is refusing to talk about any plan with a temporary ceasefire because they want an end to all hostilities before they will agree to any kind of deal. So despite the vice president's involvement, it does sound as though the two sides are still very far apart.
Sarah Smith in Washington. Thank you.
And what are the prospects for the oil price given that deadline tonight? Sean is back. What do we think, Sean?
Thanks, Anna. Well, right now it's around $111 for a barrel of Brent crude. So when we're chatting about this tomorrow morning, that's a bit of a reference point for us to go by over the course of 24 hours. Javier Blas is a Bloomberg columnist covering energy and commodities. Javier, good morning to you. How big could the moves be on the back of a deal or no deal being done?
They could be very big. If we have a deal, we have seen in the past that any suggestion that the Strait of Hormuz will reopen has triggered a 10% drop almost immediately in the price of oil. So if there was a deal, we can even see Brent potentially moving below $100 almost immediately by the time that we are speaking tomorrow morning. If there is no deal, it very much depends on the amount of destruction that we see, and particularly on the amount of retaliation that we see from Iran. Iran has threatened to attack the infrastructure of neighbors' countries in the Persian Gulf, that includes Saudi Arabia. Until now, what we have seen is a blockade of the Strait of Hormuz, but the production facilities, by large, have not been affected. So when the strait reopens, the oil can flow. If those facilities are destroyed, even if the Strait of Hormuz was to reopen immediately, then we will need to go into months and perhaps years of reconstruction, and that will mean very high prices for a very long time.
Has that changed the possibilities for higher prices for a long time compared to previous crises we've been aware of, Javier? This is something you've followed yourself for many, many years now.
Yes, I mean, the potential for very high prices for a very long time has changed significantly, because now we are beginning to see that Iran is capable of the destruction that the market fears. So I will say that in the kind of scenarios, I have covered this market for about 25 years, on the kind of scenarios that we have always discussed, we are entering into way beyond the worst case scenario that we have thought. But the next 24 hours are going to be absolutely critical to see whether we go below $100 or we go much higher and for many months.
What do you make, Javier, of the reports that some countries around the world, some that may well be seen as allies of the United States, have been able to get ships through the Strait of Hormuz because of their diplomacy with Iran?
We have seen a higher number of ships crossing the Strait of Hormuz over the last few days, particularly over the Easter holiday. And indeed, we have seen a record number of ships crossing, partly because Iran is allowing those countries, perhaps through diplomatic deals, to go. But the problem is the highest number since the strait was blocked. But we are not near the levels that they are normal. At best, we are seeing now, we have gone from zero, perhaps a couple of ships a day, to seeing 10, 15, even 16 vessels in one single day. But we need to remember that pre-war, the typical number was over 100. Most days we were seeing 120 vessels crossing the Strait of Hormuz. So yes, from going from 0 to 15 is progress, but we are nowhere near the normal level. We'll be effectively, we'll need to go 6, 7, 8 times higher to go back to normal levels.
Okay, Javier, thank you for your time this morning. Javier Blas, Bloomberg columnist. I should just let you know that there's been a big proposal to by Universal Music Group for more than £50 billion-ish from a big hedge fund, Pershing Square. Bill Ackman, who used to be on the board at UMG, has proposed that. So that could be something for us to keep an eye on in the coming days.
Thank you, Sean. It is 22 minutes past seven now. The chief executive of OpenAI, Sam Altman, has called for companies to pilot a four-day working week with no loss of pay as part of a new outline of policy ideas for responding to AI. Zoe Kleiman joins us, our technology editor. Morning, Zoe.
Morning.
People will hear those words, policy ideas for responding to AI. They'll hear a suggestion of doing less work and they'll think, what's this all about?
It does kind of feel like finally we get a carrot, don't we? With all this doom that we've been hearing about the threats and the potential problems with AI. Here is a big AI company coming out and saying, well, look, guys, you might be able to work less and get as much money. But the question is, you know, how realistic is this, honestly? This is something we've been hearing the AI sector say for quite some time. I heard Elon Musk say a few years ago, he talked about something he called universal high income. And he said, look, there's not going to be work in the way that there is now because AI is going to be doing so much of it. So, you know, let's just distribute the wealth among us. We won't have to work and we'll all have loads of money. And you think that sounds great, doesn't it? Brilliant. When does that start? But actually, in reality, knowing how these big companies work and looking at the history of how big companies operate, is it really likely that they are going to be sharing any OpenAI calls efficiency gains, productivity dividends, if you like, with the workers? Or is that likely to stay, among the very few giant companies that we have who are really operating this AI? I think there's kind of, when you read this document, it's 13 pages long and it addresses lots of issues around how society and how our economics isn't really set up to manage AI coming in the way that the tech companies keep telling us it's going to come. Then, you know, it's kind of a bit of a marketing ploy, I think. You know, hang on in there because it's going to be great. And here is one reason why you'll have to work less and you'll still get as much money. Is it realistic, though? I think a lot of people would be very cynical about that message.
Yeah, do you know, I was just wondering exactly what you were saying there. The fact that it's got a definite whiff of sales about it because it's coming from the AI industry. Is anybody outside the AI industry who perhaps have a more independent eye on it making similar suggestions?
So all of this is based on the premise that a new era of AI is coming, which is called ASI, Artificial Superintelligence, and it is as intelligent as people. And this in turn paves the way for something called AGI, Artificial General Intelligence, which is more intelligent than us. But let's start with a lot of scientists being extremely cynical about whether or not AI ever gets to that stage, and indeed why it needs to, because, you know, we already have people being as intelligent as we are. Do we need to replicate that, or do we need the tech to complement us in different ways? Lots of scientists I speak to don't actually think that will ever happen. And the AI industry will tell you that they're on course and it's going to happen very soon. But you've got to bear in mind they've been saying that for quite some time. I think there is a lot of agreement among experts that AI is hugely disruptive. We already see that. It is going to disrupt jobs. It is going to bring about a lot of change to a lot of traditional ways in which the world of work has run. And we do need to think about the impact of that on society, certainly. And I think a lot of people would say we do need to consider our policies. But also, we need to bear in mind that, you know, companies like OpenAI want it to go their way. They want to influence that policy and shape it in a way that benefits them. And I think you're right that we need to ask more broadly, where should we be going this, rather than asking the very companies that are trying to sell all of this to us in the first place.
Yeah, Zoe Kleiman, our technology editor, thank you.
And at 26 minutes past seven, it is time to turn to Cathy and the sport.
Morning. Thank you very much. Coventry City are just 4 points away from a return to top flight football after a goalless draw with Hull City last night. Frank Lampard's side are 12 points clear at the top of the Championship. And moving up into the Championship are Lincoln City, who've been promoted to football's second tier for the first time since 1961. Lincoln City beat Reading 2-1 last night. Now, the men's and women's FA Cups included a few surprises over the Easter weekend. Both Arsenal men and women were knocked out of the two tournaments. Liverpool men had a heavy 4-0 defeat to Manchester City. We can speak to the football commentator, Vicky Sparks. Morning, Vicky.
Good morning.
It's an important week for Arsenal coming up, having gone out of the FA Cup, defeated by Southampton at the weekend. They're also out of the League Cup. How careful do they have to be not to let that bleed into the Premier League and then also tonight's Champions League quarter-final against Sporting in Lisbon?
Yes, well, Mikel Arteta's message is that Arsenal are hungrier than ever ahead of that game tonight against a Sporting side who have never reached the semi-finals of the Champions League. But I think that's the key question, Cathy, isn't it? Has their mentality been rocked, firstly by the League Cup final defeat to Manchester City and then that shock FA Cup exit you mentioned to Southampton? It is, in fact, the first time that Arsenal have lost back-to-back games this season, which does underline that this campaign, they have responded well to adversity, unlike perhaps in previous seasons. They still have that 9-point cushion at the top of the Premier League, but until they win a first trophy in whatever competition since 2020, that tag of nearly men that has dogged them under Mikel Arteta hangs heavily upon them, and even more so, I think, after two results like this, and with injuries piling up too. I mean, you look at the game tonight, Gabriel, Trossard and Declan Rice will be available for this one, but Saka and Timber amongst those to miss out. But as I say, they have proved their mettle after setbacks this season. They couldn't in the FA Cup at the weekend. Time to do it in Europe tonight.
Arsenal fans will be hoping that is the case. Well, Arsenal women are 14-time FA Cup winners. How big a shot was their defeat to Brighton at the weekend?
Yeah, big shot. Both WSL sides, but Arsenal into the semi-finals of the Women's Champions League last week as reigning European champions after beating Chelsea and then knocked out of the FA Cup at the weekend. I do think those Champions League exertions may have played a part. Manager Renee Slager has also made six changes, having played that hotly contested tie against Chelsea. And Brighton sensed their opportunity, and particular credit to Brighton's bravery, having taken the lead shortly after half time, not to sit back, but to push on and get that second goal, which they did to book what in the end was a very well-deserved semi-final with Liverpool.
Yeah, and the other semi-final will be Chelsea against Manchester City, the top two sides in the Women's Super League. They had relatively straightforward FA Cup quarterfinals, but it does set up an intriguing semi-final, doesn't it?
Yes, very tasty indeed. And a repeat of the League Cup semi-final from this season as well, which Chelsea won despite Manchester City's superb form in the WSL this season. And there are so many interesting subplots to this matchup at the moment. Chelsea have won the last six league titles in a row, but they look set to be deposed by Manchester City this season. Can Chelsea sting them in the cups again? Or will City exact some revenge for that League Cup semi-final exit?
Yeah, there's a lot coming up in the next few weeks. Vicky Sparks, thank you very much. And that match we mentioned, Arsenal face Sporting in Lisbon tonight. There's commentary on 5 Live from 8 o'clock. And just a little bit of Grand National news ahead of Saturday. I am Maximus and Nick Rocket, the past two winners of the Grand National, head the confirmations for Saturday's race at Aintree, the final field. And four reserves will be announced tomorrow.
Cathy, thank you. Let us look ahead now to this evening on Radio 4 with Sue Perkins.
Nature isn't just beautiful, it's downright eccentric.
It's basically a woodlouse, but it's a tongue-eating louse.
There we go. Join me and a panel of funny, fascinating guests as we share stories, surprises and a few strange specimens. Rob, has this made you more or less a fan of crabs?
Well, I want to eat one now to see if I can help.
I wouldn't advise eating them. They do absorb heavy metals, got microplastics going on.
I'm not hearing anything I don't like.
The new series of Nature Table with me, Sue Perkins. Tuesday nights, 6:30 comedy on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
The weather today will be sunny and warm for most of us. Cloudy, but should stay dry in Northern Ireland. If you're in Western Scotland, you get the cloud and a bit of rain in the afternoon as well.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4. Anna Foster, Justin Webb. It is 7:30 exactly. Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news.
The crew of NASA's Artemis II mission have started their journey back to Earth after making history during their flight around the Moon. They reached almost 253 miles from our planet, more than any other human. One of the four astronauts said the landscape on the dark side of the Moon blew his mind, while another said he'd need to invent new adjectives to describe a solar eclipse they'd witnessed. President Trump has reiterated his threat to destroy bridges and power plants in Iran tonight if the country doesn't agree to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. He also said negotiations with Tehran were underway. A regional official has told the BBC there are no signs of a breakthrough in the talks. The Israeli military has this morning told people in Iran not to use trains or go near railway lines. Earlier, Israel said it had carried out another wave of strikes in Tehran and across Iran. The United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia and Bahrain have again faced missile strikes from Iran. Resident doctors in England have begun a six-day strike in a dispute with the government about pay and job opportunities. The NHS says patients should seek help as normal. Jack Fletcher from the Doctors Union, the BMA, told us the action was entirely avoidable. The walkout was called after the government watered down proposals they'd been discussing. The Department of Health insisted its offer was generous. The managing director of Wireless Festival in London has defended the decision to invite the American rapper Kanye West to perform at the event in July, despite his anti-Semitic comments. Melvin Benn encouraged people to offer Kanye West forgiveness. The performer has apologised and blamed his bipolar disorder after he sold swastika T-shirts and released a song praising Adolf Hitler. One of Australia's most decorated soldiers has been arrested for allegedly murdering unarmed prisoners while serving in Afghanistan. Ben Robert Smith denies shooting four Afghans and ordering others to shoot people not engaged in hostilities.
Thank you, Caroline. The entire country can be taken out in one night, and that night might be tomorrow night, so said President Trump in his latest press conference on Iran. His deadline to make a ceasefire deal and reopen the Strait of Hormuz is due to expire in the early hours of Wednesday, our time. And that explicit threat to target civilian infrastructure, potentially committing war crimes in the process, is clearly designed to make the Iranian regime capitulate. But so far, it doesn't appear to be. Lise Doucette is our chief international correspondent. Lise, good morning. You are monitoring, as always, the status of what's going on in the background, the talks that are happening in the shadows. What do we know?
Well, this is a critical day. If this, what's said to be frantic rounds of, well, we could call it diplomacy, but it seems to be mainly the exchange of messages, indirect talks between the United States and Iran, principally going through Pakistan. The French news agency quoted Iran's ambassador to Pakistan saying that efforts to end the war are at a critical, sensitive stage. And yet, we, as you heard from Sarah Smith earlier in the program, J.D. Vance is supposed to have been drawn into these negotiations, and yet he's expected in Hungary this afternoon to support an embattled U.S. ally in the elections there. So it's always hard to know what's happening behind the scenes, but there certainly will be efforts as the clock counts down towards President Trump's deadline, which he says is final. But what we seem to have had so far, Anna, is you had the Americans with their 15-point plan with really ultimatums to Iran, a shopping list of what they've been asking from Iran for years, and Iran has rejected in the past. And of course, Iran and the region is in a whole new place now, and the leadership is in a whole new place with so many assassinated by Israel during these weeks of war. Iran then responded with its own 10-point plan yesterday and reiterating points that it had also made previously. This often happens in negotiations, Anna, but these are negotiations, or this is a process of mediation that I think even the most experienced mediators, and these are not the most experienced mediators, traditional mediators on this crisis, would find difficult. The Iranian leaders who are said to be involved in this process are in hiding. They know it's said that they have been taken off the kill list, but still there would be some amongst them who would be worried that if they emerged, if they meet, they would be assassinated. There are no direct channels as far as we can see, and there's absolutely no trust. Iran insists that there cannot be a ceasefire. And why is that? Well, the last time there was a ceasefire in the June 2025 war, well, we see what happens. There's another war. Iran wants a permanent end and guarantees that there will be no more wars. And so we have to wait and see. President Trump said that Iran's proposal is significant but not good enough. Will it give him an off-ramp, or will he carry out what would be a huge, huge escalation in this war?
It would, and at least on a practical level. I mean, we started by saying that he talks about taking out the entire country in one night. I mean, Iran, put it very simply, is a big place. I mean, he's talking about an escalation, but he can't really achieve exactly what he's talking about, can he?
But they can inflict damage. And for all of the bravado of the Iranian leadership being played out, not just in their statements from the foreign ministry and what we see on social media taunting President Trump, as I'm sure some of our listeners are following it, saying Iran is winning the social media war. But of course, that's not the main factor affecting the war on the ground. The mighty American military, backed up by Israel, can certainly inflict damage. damage. But the assessment all along of Iran, even before this war began, was that if they hunker down, if they just use whatever they have, and we're seeing they're still, this morning, they are still firing back at Israel and at Gulf states. They'll use their asymmetric advantages, which have been on full display, and wait this through, because for them, there's a greater danger for them to submit to President Trump's ultimatums. They are not going to give in to all of his diktats. They don't like his language, and they've made that clear, and they don't like his terms of surrender. Let's wait and see whether they've been truly, truly misguided and mistaken in their assessments. But they believe that they've got the upper hand. They've weaponized the Strait of Hormuz. They believe that they are on, they have a lot more to fight and can continue this fight. President Trump, of course, can't believe it. He says, why aren't they surrendering? He said that before the war, and he continues to reflect that in thinking that, well, I'll just make these threats, and of course they'll come to the table. You'd be mad if you didn't come to the table. But Iran is fighting a very different war with a very different perception of this war, and very, very different end game, very different long game.
Lise, thank you. Lise Doucette, our chief international correspondent. Ali Vyas is also with us, the Iran project director at the think tank, The Crisis Group. Ali, what conversations, what discussions, what thought processes do you think will be happening in Tehran right now?
Well, the Iranians, as Lise was saying, are pretty confident in their position right now, and they know that they still have sufficient firepower to retaliate in a scenario that the U.S. targets their critical infrastructure. They can basically create a scorched earth situation in the rest of the Gulf, as well as in Israel. And that would create the circumstances that would be disastrous for President Trump as well. If the Houthis come in, they close the Bab al-Mandab, the access to the Red Sea, about two-thirds of Saudi and Emirati energy that is now getting to Asian markets will be gone. And if production in these countries is also targeted, then we're talking about oil prices not coming down anytime soon in the next few months or years. And that, again, in an election year for President Trump would be disastrous. If he puts boots on the ground and there are higher American casualties and fatalities, that too would be very problematic. So they understand that the U.S. might be able to inflict significant amount of harm on them, but they believe that they have a higher threshold for pain.
Mm. Ali, this might seem like quite an obvious question, but we don't see Iran in the way that we see other countries. What impact would sustained attacks on bridges, on power plants, actually have on the civilian population there, what President Trump is threatening to do?
Look, the reality is that despite years of corruption, mismanagement, the Islamic Republic still had maintained a lot of the infrastructure that was built under the monarchy and even had added to them. They were not necessarily in a good shape, but Iran was nowhere near a failed state situation that we have seen in some other countries in the region, like Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, so on. And of course, this is a country of 92 million. So if indeed infrastructure is taken out, then I think we would see waves of refugees coming out of Iran that would make anything that Europeans have experienced so far with instability in Iraq or in Syria pale in comparison. There is also, obviously, the public opinion inside the country would completely turn against this war, because this would now be seen not as a war against the Iranian government, but against Iran as a state, with the aim of turning it into an ungovernable system that cannot recover from this war.
At this point, if the American government genuinely did want to make some sort of ceasefire agreement with the Iranians, rather than making threats of violence, what would they realistically need to do or to say or to offer to try and make that happen?
Well, first is to basically demonstrate that they are serious in their goodwill of trying to get a mutually beneficial agreement. And that would be, instead of the president doubling down on threats, actually moving away some of U.S. military assets from the region. I think the Iranians would pay much more attention to what Trump does than what he says. That's number one. And number two, there has to be some sign of flexibility in US's position. The US has asked Iran to dismantle its nuclear program, to abandon supporting proxies in the region, and to put limits on its missile program. If any of those demands are toned down or postponed to the future, or maybe more serious offer of sanctions relief is put on the table, then the Iranians might think that Trump's calculus has shifted. But for now, they still believe that he wants to strong-arm them into bending a knee, and that is something that is just totally unacceptable to them.
Ali Vyas, the Iran Project Director at the Crisis Group think tank. Thank you.
18 minutes to 8 is the time. Should the rapper Kanye West be allowed to perform in the UK? The managing director of the London Festival that's invited him here in July has defended that decision. West himself says he suffers from bipolar disorder. He's apologised for his previous anti-Semitic rants, including a threat to go DEFCON 3 on Jewish people. Let's talk to Andrew Trendle, who is the news editor of NME, the music newspaper. Good morning to you.
Morning, Justin. How's it going?
Good, thanks. Tell us more about what the festival directors are saying.
They're basically saying that, you know, his music's out there. It's publicly available. They're just giving him the chance to platform his music. It's not about anything else, but apart from the fact that it is coming from a place of forgiveness and second chances with Melvin Benn, saying that he himself, you know, has been close to people with mental health issues who have said some abhorrent things themselves. And so he's, you know, coming from that of a place of platforming second chances. So he has been very, very vocal in saying that he is, you know, pro-Jewish people, pro-Jewish state, as well as being pro-Palestine. He's just said this is about second chances and, you know, thinking about how we treat people with mental health. And in the last 20 minutes, Kanye West has just shared an updated apology himself via the festival, saying that he's been following the conversation very closely. His only goal is to come to London and present a show about change, unity, peace. He knows it's more about words than he himself. He says he wants to do the work, which I think is what people are looking for.
I suppose, and Melvin Benn, we should make clear, is the managing director, isn't he, of Wireless. I suppose the issue is whether it is or should be in his power to forgive, because the stuff wasn't aimed at him. It's for other people to forgive or not to forgive Kanye West, isn't it? Which presumably is what a lot of those in the music industry who are concerned about this will feel.
Indeed, it's an interesting time. I mean, this is the thing people are saying, what's going to happen next? It's quite unpredictable to see what's going to happen. There were the reports of him headlining Wireless leaked a few weeks back, maybe a month or two ago, when people, oh, that can't be right. But here we are, and we'll see. I mean, tickets go on pre-sale today. Curious to see how much of the public go for it.
I mean, if the public do go for it and they don't get a lot of the sponsors, which it looks as if they're not, do they still make money? In other words, this is about forgiveness, or is it about money?
Oh, it's about, it sounds like the platform is there for the festival to go ahead.
In a financially secure way because of an amount of tickets they'd sell.
Yeah, I know. It's hard to imagine them planning this without a view of some kind of sponsorship pulling out. But I would assume that given the level that they're on, given that they're planning ahead, given that the statements that have come out today from Kanye saying, I'm planning to come, it sounds like that it would still be financially viable to go ahead.
And they would be giving him a live platform.
Yeah, but they have. He said that they've both said, the festival and Kanye said, it's about nothing but music. So one would hope that if it goes ahead, you would hope that Kanye would use that platform to bring about some kind of sense of community, you would hope.
Do you have a feeling, the impression that, assuming the government doesn't ban it, which they still could do, the Home Secretary might, but if it were to go ahead, that it would be something welcomed within the broader music community?
It's so divisive. I'm not sure. It's the thing. It's like where, you know, the people talk about separating art from the artist. People talk about where the line is. It's about more than an apology. As Kanye himself, it's you have to do the work. It was 5 years, no, three, a few years of these kind of comments. These really, really disgusting comments. These, you know, the song he released, everything. You can't go from, you know, 3 years of that to a simple apology. I think it depends on what kind of work, what kind of visibility you see. But right now, there's a fair amount of anger and disgust around. But there's also, you know, it depends on how people feel about this, you know, this opportunity of second chances in the work that's to come.
All right. Andrew Trendell, thank you very much.
We will speak in just a moment to the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, on what the government's doing to try to prevent resident doctors in England continuing to strike. But before that, it is time for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is the Reverend Angela Tilby, Canon Emeritus of Christ Church, Oxford.
Good morning. In the Christian calendar, Easter is not just Easter Day, but the beginning of a long season which goes on for 50 days until Ascension Tide and Pentecost, and all with the message of the triumph of life over death. One well-known Christian song, Sidney Carter's Lord of the Dance, has Jesus saying, "They cut me down and I leap up high. I am the life that'll never, never die." But that isn't quite how it is in the Bible. The resurrection is more elusive, a vision here, a glimpse there. It can't be fully grasped, wrapped up, or completed. I was thinking about this in church on Sunday. I often sit near a play area where small children run around with crayons and paper and furry animals while the service goes on. As we sang our Easter hymns and the children played, I found myself thinking of friends and members of our congregation who had died the previous year, and how I miss them, and I wonder whether they're around somehow. Death is real. Whatever happened in the resurrection does not cancel out the crucifixion. There is a loss, there is an absence. And for Jesus, the wounds of the cross remain. Jesus shows his pierced hands and side to doubting Thomas. The reason death has meaning is that we value life. One of the things I really like about the Easter stories is that when Jesus appears, it's often in ordinary circumstances, the kind we take for granted. On the road to a nearby village, round a dinner table, over a meal of grilled fish. When I think about friends who have died, it's the little gestures that I miss. A sparkling smile, a contemptuous turn of the head, a raucous laugh. Easter makes me grateful that every life counts and every death has meaning. I can't get over-enthusiastic about any straightforward link between death and glory. I understand how it may feel appropriate when young men and women respond to the challenge to sacrifice themselves for their country or for another cause. But I'm more sympathetic to the ordinary view that says, life on earth matters now. Heaven can wait. As tension continues this week in the Middle East, we can assume there'll be threats, boasts, bombing, risk, and much that we cannot see and do not know. Life and death are always in conflict. The resurrection does not cancel the cross, and the hope of heaven does not negate the sacredness of everyday life. As we anticipate the possibility of even greater destruction, I have to keep believing that every life matters, and it doesn't have to be like this.
That was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Angela Tilby. It's just coming round to 10 to 8.
The latest strike by junior doctors, resident doctors as they're now known, is underway in England. The government's showing no signs of willingness to do any kind of deal with them unless they back down. Let us talk to Wes Streeting, the Health Secretary for England, who is in our Westminster studio. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Just first of all on this £3 billion figure. So a lot of the papers saying it is costing these strikes, it has cost £3 billion in 3 years. Is that an official government figure?
That we think that strikes cost £50 million a day. And so that was an accurate reflection of the costs of these strikes.
And what the junior doctors, resident doctors representative told us earlier in the programme an hour ago is that it's pretty much, roughly speaking, the cost of funding what they want. So instead of spending this money on efforts to get round the strike, you could have just spent the money on them and they'd be perfectly happy.
Well, it is true that in order to deliver full pay restoration back to 2008 levels, using the RPI count of inflation, it would probably cost in the order of £3 billion to do that. Of course, that would be £3 billion a year. And of course, then... it would cost £3 billion a year is what it would cost every year to deliver full pay restoration. Let's then assume that other NHS staff would understandably demand the same. Then that cost would be more like £30 billion a year. That is more than the entire cost of the Ministry of Justice's entire budget for running the criminal justice system. Now, this goes to the heart of the intransigence of the BMA. despite being the biggest winner by a country mile of public sector pay increases since this government came in. 28.9% is what they got from us within weeks of taking office. They still went out on strike. Since January, we've negotiated in good faith with BMA officers with a deal on the table that would have given them an average 4.9% this year, and they still went out on strikes. That deal also included an extra 4,500 specialty training places, 1,000 of which would have materialised this month, the reimbursement of mandatory exam fees, which can amount to thousands of pounds per doctor, and they have still gone on strike. And finally, I would just point out that while rejecting this government's offer of a 4.9% average pay increase for resident doctors, which can be as high as 7.1% for some doctors, the BMA are offering their own staff 2.75% on affordability grounds.
Although
there's a word for that, and I think your listeners will decide who in this dispute has been more unreasonable.
Well, I asked Dr. Jack Fletcher, who chairs the Resident Doctors Committee, exactly about that. So they've got their own staff on strike at the moment. They're not offering them anything like the kind of money that you've offered to the junior doctor. He said, we support the strikers. He said he from the Resident Doctors perspective, thinks that those people on strike at the BMA should be supported. So he himself personally, and nor are the residents' doctors, he says, hypocrites.
Well, if only they had the power to do something about it as officers of the BMA. That sounds like a big dollop of cakeism, but it is Easter, I suppose. So maybe there's some left over. There's a serious point here. The Resident Doctors Committee are adopting an increasingly absurd set of positions. They seem to think on one hand they can reject this deal and get all of the benefits. They seem to think that this government should, within 2 years, do something that it took the last Labour government more than a decade to achieve. And the reason they peg back to 2008 is because after more than a decade of Labour government, they had seen year-on-year pay rises. They were much better off thanks to Labour. I don't pretend that I have solved all of the issues facing resident doctors in less than 2 years. All I ask of the BMA is to stop pretending to their members that I can.
And
look at the state of the public finances, look at the state of our public services, and look at the state of the world. And in the context of having been the standout winner across the entire public sector, I think the BMA really need to consider whether their action is reasonable.
The extra 1,000 training posts, which have now been withdrawn as a result of the BMA not accepting the previous offer, could those extra 1,000 be back on the table?
Not in time for September, no, for two reasons. One is the reason why I was really keen to get the deal over the line before Easter, and I was really upfront with resident doctors representatives back in earlier in the new year, is because operationally we need to have got those applications open this month in time for the autumn. And financially, we can now no longer afford to fund those places because of this week's strike action.
Right, so it's off for this year. I want to ask you about what Sir Jim McKee has been saying, the NHS England's CEO, who's been talking to the Health Service Journal and suggesting that in some hospital trusts, actually they found things ran rather better when the junior doctors, the resident doctors, were on strike. He seemed to be suggesting that there are different ways of organising the NHS in England in the future that might reduce the impact of resident doctors if they carry on with these strikes. Is that something you're interested in exploring?
Well, it is true to say that thanks to the efforts of other NHS staff, particularly consultants, and thanks to the hard work of NHS leaders, we've managed to mitigate against strike action and its disruption more effectively under this government than under our predecessors.
But could you organise things differently?
We can and we do. I do place a high value on doctors. I'm not interested particularly in doctor substitution. And this is the irony of the BMA's position and, frankly, the position they have put me in. I do not have my door banged down every day by NHS leaders saying what we really need in our hospital right now is more training places. They don't say that. They're very happy to continue with what's known as locally employed doctors, where resident doctors are in jobs but don't get all of the added perks, benefits of training, including higher pay. It's the resident doctors that have been banging on my door for the training places because of the bottlenecks they're experiencing. And so I've actually found, my own position coming into this job as health secretary, one of enormous sympathy to resident doctors, the arguments they were making. I've been very willing to help. In fact,
just on this point, you're not considering then what Jim McKee seems to be suggesting, which is that you reorganise the whole business of the health service so that the dependency on junior doctors is reduced.
Well, if we are in a period of prolonged strike action by the BMA, of course we need to take mitigating action. And it's not my job to micromanage the health service and to tell Jim Mackey and other NHS leaders how to run their services.
It's my job
to fund them properly, give them their resources and to hold them to account for performance. So Jim's got my full backing in this. I just say to the BMA listening and to resident doctors listening to bear in mind two things. One is, as a health secretary, as a government, we've been enormously sympathetic to the arguments they've made about the bad treatment they had under our predecessors, and we've taken action. Yeah. And secondly, on jobs and training places, I took the decision to rush through emergency legislation through Parliament with the support of opposition parties, which reduced the competition for training places from 4-1 to less than 2-1 by prioritising UK graduates of medical schools for those places. Didn't do that as a negotiating tactic. We've delivered it.
Okay.
And the BMA have responded by going out
on
strike.
I just want to ask you very briefly before we go, or before you go, about Kanye West. We were talking about 10 minutes or so ago. He's issued a statement saying he wants to come to Britain. Should he?
Well, the decision as to whether he's let in is a legal decision for Home Office, and I'm not going to prejudice that decision by commenting. Should he be headlining the Wireless Festival? Absolutely not. Look at his behaviour. Not one or two off-colour remarks. He released a song called Heil Hitler, plastered it across T-shirts, issued a mealy-mouthed and self-serving apology, and now expects people to feel sorry for him. I'm only too sorry that the festival organisers have chosen to platform him, given that behaviour, and then to offer the fig leaf of credibility with an absolutely absurd statement issued overnight. If he wants forgiveness, it's not my forgiveness that he needs. It's the forgiveness of Jewish communities, and I don't think he's done anything to earn it.
Worth treating. Thank you.
Quick check of the weather. Here's Darren Bett.
Yeah, lovely day today. It's going to be dry, sunny and warmer than yesterday, turning out to be the warmest day of the year so far. The only change is going to come across Northern Ireland and Western Scotland, where we'll see more cloud during the afternoon. South to southeasterly breeze is bringing the warmth in Northern Ireland because of the cloud. Temperatures will be 15 degrees. Warmer in Scotland, 19 or 20 Celsius here. Warmer still across England and Wales, 19 to 21 degrees. Could make 22 degrees, though, across parts of Wales.
Thank you for that. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Justin Webb.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 7th of April. The headlines today: the crew of NASA's Artemis 2 mission are on their way back to Earth, having captured rare images of the far side of the moon. After the news, we will hear from the British scientist who's at the heart of the mission in Houston.
It's a privilege to get to sit in those rooms. And, you know, it's sort of very humbling. And I felt just super honored to be able to just be in there and, you know, see all these incredible sights.
President Trump has given Iran until tonight to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, threatening to target civilian infrastructure if his demands aren't met. We'll get the take of a former US Middle East envoy. And resident doctors in England are on strike for the 15th time in their long-running dispute with the government.
And also coming up in the next hour, Kanye West has issued a new apology for his anti-Semitic actions this morning. We will get more reaction to that. And
my father does not like waiting in queues. A queue, to him, means a man being denied the right to be where he wants to be at a time of his own choosing, which is at the front now.
The poet and life writer behind the best-selling And When Did You Last See Your Father gives his top tips for budding memoirists. The news is read this morning by Caroline Nichols.
The crew of NASA's Artemis II mission are beginning their journey home to Earth after travelling around the Moon. In doing so, they voyaged more than 252,000 miles into space, further than any human has gone before. As they passed around the far side of the Moon, the four astronauts on board the Orion spacecraft lost contact with ground control in a planned communications blackout. Our science editor, Rebecca Morell, sent this report from Johnson Space Center in Houston.
A close encounter with the Moon, and a view that humans haven't witnessed for more than 50 years.
There are islands of terrain out there that are completely surrounded by darkness. Up to the north, there is a very nice double crater. It looks like a snowman.
Before they made the flyby, the Artemis astronauts made history.
Integrity crew, on April 15, 1970, during the Apollo 13 mission, three explorers set the record for the farthest distance humans have ever traveled from our home planet. Today, for all humanity, you're pushing beyond that frontier.
As the four astronauts voyaged onwards, they named some of the moon's features, a crater now called Integrity after their spacecraft, and another named after Artemis commander Reid Wiseman's late wife Carol, who died 6 years ago. During the flyby, the constant contact with mission control was broken for a tense 40 minutes when the signal from their spacecraft was blocked by the moon itself.
Houston, we have you the same, and it is so great to hear from Earth again.
Then relief, as their link with Earth was re-established. And if these close-up views weren't enough, the astronauts had one more celestial treat, a solar eclipse that was just for them, as the sun vanished behind the moon, its outer atmosphere glowing in the darkness of space.
President Trump has repeated his threat to destroy civilian infrastructure in Iran tonight if the country doesn't agree to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. He said he was not worried about warnings that attacking civilian targets could be a war crime. Our North America editor Sarah Smith reports from Washington.
Donald Trump has threatened to target Iran's bridges and power plants in a massive attack if the country does not meet his imminent deadline for agreeing to a deal. He's demanding that any agreement includes Iran reopening international shipping lanes in the Strait of Hormuz. The two sides are engaged in negotiations but appear to be far apart, with President Trump saying a 10-part plan put forward by Iran is not good enough. Iran has rejected any proposal that includes a temporary ceasefire, demanding a complete end to hostilities instead. In over 5 weeks of this conflict, other deadlines imposed by Donald Trump have come and gone. He's often threatened to bomb Iran back to the Stone Age and then extended his time frame. But he said it was highly unlikely he would extend his deadline this time.
The Israeli military has told people in Iran to avoid trains and railway lines. In a post on social media, it said that anyone failing to do so would be putting their life at risk. From Jerusalem, Daniel DeSimone reports.
In a post in Farsi on social media, the Israel Defense Forces gave what it described as an urgent warning to train passengers in Iran, saying that using or being near railways today will endanger life. There was a weeks-long internet blackout in Iran, meaning that social media posts will be seen by very few people. Overnight, Israel carried out a wave of airstrikes in Iran. President Trump is threatening to obliterate Iranian civilian infrastructure unless Iran fully opens the Strait of Hormuz by tonight. But the UN is warning that airstrikes in Iran have already caused high numbers of civilian casualties, while strikes on critical infrastructure have disrupted basic services.
A six-day strike by tens of thousands of resident doctors in England has begun. It's their 15th walkout since March 2023 and one of the longest since the start of the dispute about pay and jobs. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
Health leaders say that working around this strike will be challenging as it comes straight after the bank holiday weekend when some community services are closed and hospitals have been under more pressure. They say with some staff booking leave, it's been harder to plan and fill rotas. But with senior doctors moved to cover emergency departments, NHS England says urgent care will continue as normal. It also says that 95% of planned treatment and operations will go ahead, though this will still mean thousands of postponements.
Jack Fletcher from the British Medical Association told us the action was entirely avoidable, but the walkout was called after the government watered down proposals they'd been discussing. Speaking on this programme, the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, described resident doctors as the biggest winners of public sector pay increases.
28.9% is what they got from us. They still went out on strike. Since January, we've negotiated in good faith with a deal on the table that would have given them an average 4.9% this year. That deal also included an extra 4,500 specialty training places, the reimbursement of mandatory exam fees, and they have still gone on strike.
The American rapper Kanye West has offered to meet members of the Jewish community in the UK in response to calls for his performance at a festival in London to be cancelled because of anti-Semitic comments he'd made in the past. In a statement, he said he wanted to address directly those he had hurt. The managing director of Wireless Festival has encouraged people to offer the rapper forgiveness. Reform UK says if it wins the next general election, it will stop issuing visas to citizens of countries that demand reparations from the UK for its role in the slave trade. The party said such nations were ignoring the fact that Britain made huge sacrifices to be the first major power to outlaw slavery. Our political correspondent Damien Grammaticus reports.
Britain was one of the leading nations involved in the slave trade, transporting an estimated 3 million Africans across the Atlantic, before abolishing the practice in the early 1800s. In recent years, a number of Caribbean countries have said they want to seek reparatory justice for the legacy of damaged lives, including an apology, help with development, and possible compensation. Reform UK's Home Affairs spokesperson Zia Yusuf said the UK had made huge sacrifices to outlaw slavery, and if in government, his party would stop issuing new visas to nationals of any state that formally demanded reparations. Sir Keir Starmer has said slavery was abhorrent and indicated the UK would not discuss reparations but could talk about helping countries with challenges they were facing right now. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, has said the UK should not pay compensation for a practice it helped end.
Australia's most decorated living soldier has been arrested for allegedly murdering unarmed prisoners while serving in Afghanistan. Ben Robert Smith is accused of shooting four unarmed Afghans and of ordering others to shoot people not engaged in hostilities. He's denied any wrongdoing. From Sydney, here's our Australia correspondent, Katie Watson.
Ben Robert Smith had been considered a national hero after being awarded the Victoria Cross for conspicuous gallantry action in an operation to hunt a senior commander of the Taliban. The former soldier, who left the Defence Force in 2013, later faced a 7-year legal battle with newspapers over reports of serious misconduct while he was deployed to Afghanistan. The former soldier has denied all wrongdoing and, until now, had not faced criminal charges.
The Taiwanese opposition leader Zhang Liwang has arrived in Shanghai for the first visit to China in a decade. The chairwoman of the Kuomintang party called it a journey for peace at a time when Beijing is increasing military pressure on the self-governing island. But Taiwan's ruling Democratic Party accused her of submitting to China's Communist Party. Beijing sees Taiwan as its own and has not excluded the use of force to take it. The price of stamps goes up today. The cost of posting a first-class letter is rising by 10 pence to £1.80. A second-class stamp is increasing by 4 pence to 91 pence. Royal Mail says the price increases are necessary because fewer letters are being sent while the number of addresses is increasing. Here's our business correspondent, Jonathan Josephs.
Royal Mail is under growing pressure on several fronts, but to try to ease the financial strain of its obligation to deliver letters across the UK 6 days a week, it's putting stamp prices up. Many businesses and consumers are unhappy the increase is going ahead despite the company's failure to hit performance targets. Just 77% of first-class letters are being delivered within one working day, against a target of 93%. Royal Mail's owner admitted to Parliament last month that the service wasn't perfect, but said he had a plan to fix the situation.
Jonathan Josephs reporting.
Thank you, Caroline. It is 10 minutes past eight. It's been a night where history was made.
Yeah, from the cabin of integrity here, as we surpass the furthest distance humans have ever traveled from planet Earth, we do so in honoring the extraordinary efforts and feats of our predecessors in human space exploration. We will continue our journey even further into space before Mother Earth succeeds in pulling us back to everything that we hold dear. But we most importantly, choose this moment to challenge this generation and in the next to make sure this record is not long lived.
And that was the moment that man travelled further than ever before. And then, soon after, the next milestone, just before midnight UK time, when for the first time in more than 50 years, there were humans who were completely unreachable by anyone on Earth.
And to all of you down there on Earth and around Earth, we love you from the moon.
Houston copies. We'll see you on the other side.
And a little more than 40 minutes of anxious breath holding in Houston followed before contact was restored.
Houston, Integrity, comm check.
Integrity, we have you loud and clear. How many?
Houston, we have you the same, and it is so great to hear from Earth again.
Well, the crew spent much of the night recording pen portraits of what they'd seen, including this description from Artemis pilot Victor Glover of the Terminator. That is the dividing line between the illuminated and dark hemispheres of the moon.
There's just so much magic in the Terminator. The islands of light, the valleys, the what look like black holes. You'd fall straight to the center of the moon if you stepped in some of those. It's just so visually captivating that the Terminator is the most striking thing that I've seen so far.
And there was one more sight for Victor Glover to record overnight, a spectacular solar eclipse.
It is bright, and the Earth shine is very distinct, and it creates quite an impressive visual illusion. Wow, it's amazing.
This is, of course, a historic mission. There was a nod to that as well, because the crew were played a message from Jim Lovell, one of only three people to have been to the moon twice, that he recorded specially before his death last year.
Hello, Artemis II. This is Apollo astronaut Jim Lovell. Welcome to my old neighborhood. When Frank Borman and Bill Anders and I orbited the moon on Apollo 8, we got humanity's first up-close look at the moon and got a view of the home planet that inspired and united people around the world. I'm proud to pass that torch on to you as you swing around the moon and lay the groundwork for missions to Mars for the benefit of all. It's a historic day, and I know how busy you'll be, but don't forget to enjoy the view.
Well, Rebecca Morell is the BBC's science editor, has been following this throughout. Probably the best job in the BBC at the moment, actually, Rebecca. I think most people would probably agree.
It's,
isn't it?
It's not bad.
No, it's not bad at all.
Just listening, yeah, amazing.
And you were going to say there, that message from Jim Lovell. I mean, there are lots of things about this particular mission that make the hairs stand up on the back of your arms, but that was definitely one of those moments.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the astronauts were woken up this morning with that message. We were actually standing in mission control when that message was played out. You could see the team here at Houston, at the Johnson Space Center, you know, sitting behind their banks of desks, concentrating hard on the data that was streaming in from the spacecraft. And then to hear this message from Jim Lovell recorded before he died, played out to the astronauts. I mean, that must have been something extraordinary for them to hear, you know, so far away, a quarter of a million miles away, just before they were able to witness some of the same sights that the Apollo astronauts witnessed 50 years ago and see some parts of the moon that had never been seen by human eyes before too.
Yeah, and you know, so much of this, it's about, as you say, it's about science and data and facts and figures, but actually it produces, as you've shown in the last week as well, quite an emotional reaction as well. It's not just numbers, it's not just data.
No, that's right. I mean, I think for me, I mean, when we saw the launch a few days ago, I think I couldn't quite get over the fact that there were four human beings sitting on top of that huge 100 meter tall rocket blasting off into space. And just now, you know, because it's 2 a.m. in the morning, the astronauts are sleeping. I am not sleeping. I'm still here chatting.
You're talking
to
us.
But we, yes, they've had a scheduled nap. I'm waiting for mine. But, you know, I went outside to take a look at the moon. And, you know, just this idea that people are back there flying around it, seeing this thing that we look up at all the time. You know, they're there up close and they're seeing parts of it that we don't see here, the far side. You know, some bits they saw the near side of the moon, the side that faces the Earth as they started their flyby, and then they went behind it. So, I mean, I'm very excited about getting these images back from the astronauts, because they've done beautiful audio descriptions, you know, as we just heard there. You know, it's perfect for radio, really. But seeing some of the imagery to match that up. I mean, they were talking about the colours on the lunar surface. I mean, you know, think the moon is just grey, black and white. Think again, they were talking about shades of green, blue and brown. They spoke about the textures, the fact that some of the younger craters were much brighter. So, and those descriptions are really important, of course. The scientists have asked them to do those. They were lovely for us to listen to, but they wanted these descriptions because they give the images the context. They bring them to life for the science team. So I think matching up the two is the images. Some of them are going to be streamed back. Of course, some of them, they've taken thousands of them. Some of them are going to come back on the cameras because it would just take too long to sort of send all of them back to Earth. But yeah, I know the scientists here, we've been speaking to some of them. They can't wait to get their hands on them and see what these astronauts have been seeing.
Yeah, they're really looking forward to that, aren't they? Rebecca, thank you. Rebecca Morrell, the BBC science editor. Well, I've been speaking to one of those scientists as well, Dr. Nikki Fox, who is from Hitchin in Hertfordshire, but she was in mission control for all of this because she is head of science at NASA.
It was very, very emotional, and I definitely teared up a number of times. It's a privilege to get to sit in those rooms. And, you know, it's sort of very humbling. And I felt just super honored to be able to just be in there and see, you know, see all these incredible sights. There were some questions that came, particularly from Christina, that made the whole room go, ooh, we've got a question. And so everybody got the answer quickly and sent it back via Kelsey. And so it was very exciting.
How much nervousness is there at a moment like that? Because we were focusing a lot yesterday on the fact that there was this slightly over 40-minute period where there's no contact at all with the astronauts. And obviously it's something that you are prepared for and ready for, but it feels like a strange moment.
Yes. Now, I will say that, you know, we are used to at NASA losing contact with our missions when they go past a distant planet or the sun, or, you know, I mean, we have these eclipse periods where you can't communicate with your spacecraft. For me, it was just, oh, okay, this is the time that we can't talk to them, and then this is the time we can. We just actually talked to the crew, just did a couple of question and answer sessions. And one of them was asked about, you know, how did it feel when you couldn't communicate with the Earth anymore? And I think they said it was quite nice. And they just focused on doing the science, and they just went into this. This was their closest approach to the moon, also their furthest away from the Earth point during that outage. And so that was when they were doing probably some of their best, most exciting observations, because, you know, the human eye attached to a human brain is so powerful because you don't have to pre-program it. And they're going to look at what the most interesting thing is. Jeremy had brought some maple cookies with him. And so at the very beginning of the loss of communication, they all had a maple cookie, and then they went straight back into doing their science. So super excited to see what images they've taken.
Yeah, I know there's a lot more still to find out, but as you say, this isn't just a mission to go back to the moon. There's so much that we'll learn from it. And tell me about what you perhaps have discovered overnight that you found particularly striking, just in those first bits of information that you've managed to get back so far.
Christina talked about how when they got round sort of the, you know, to the far side of the moon, you're very used to what you see on the near side of the moon because it's the easiest side for us to observe. And then when they went round onto that far side and they actually saw parts of the moon that no human eye has actually seen before, just because of the orbit that they took. But she was talking about how the new small craters that obviously have been formed very recently were super bright. You know, they also talked about how the magnetic pull of the Earth and the sort of the much, much less impacts on the near side of the moon made it look, you know, it looks quite sort of dark compared to the far side of the moon, which has got all these bright patches. It was Victor talking about the colors that he was seeing, that he was actually able to see sort of browns and blues. You know, that was an interesting thing to know, that the human eye could see it. And it wasn't just because you could, you know, overanalyze an image, but that with their own eyes, they were actually talking about the colors that they were seeing. I think I had sort of two highlights. One was when they were really talking about the Terminator science, and so where it goes from the dark to the sunlit piece of the moon, it allows you to see some really interesting like shadows, and you can really see craters and you can see depth. And they were describing it as a very jagged edge, whereas of course when you draw the line, you think more of a smooth line that just cuts between the dark and the sunlight. But because of the various craters and things on the moon, it was making the line very wiggly. When they said it, and I was looking at the image, and I was like, oh wow, it really is. That really is not a straight line. And so, you know, it was kind of that doing science almost with them, which was really fun. And then, of course, the other big excitement for me as a solar scientist was seeing the total solar eclipse.
Yeah, I mean, what a moment.
That even took me by surprise because, you know, intellectually, I know exactly what happens during a total solar eclipse. Because it was, you know, the moon is obviously so close to them, you saw the sun disappearing and getting sort of, you know, down to that sliver of light. But then it really felt like the corona just sort of blossomed out from behind the moon. And I mean, like a sort of flower or something, you know, just blooming. And it was so instantaneous. You know, you just went from sun just went to a sliver and then this corona appeared. It really took me by surprise. And I'm used to total solar eclipses.
Your team was involved in actually training the astronauts. And I was thinking about this. You spend years getting them ready for actually what is quite a narrow window of opportunity, isn't it? They need to be so ready to do so much in such a fixed and relatively small period of time.
That's true. But of course, you know, what the training that we do is for a lot of the astronauts. And so you're really thinking about not just the training for Artemis II, which is, you know, obviously really, really important to us as first human eyes on the far side of the moon for more than 50 years. But then, you know, all of the learning, all the teaching, all the you know, the methods that the team really put into training these astronauts are going to be invaluable for particularly Artemis IV and beyond when we're actually down on the lunar surface. You know, already training, already thinking about what kind of samples do you want somebody to pick up? You know, what are the interesting things to tell them to look for? And so I think it's just sort of, for me, it's like mission one of many missions where we will have our geology teams working really closely with the astronauts because every moment with them is precious. And whether you have a few hours of a flyby at the far side of the moon or you have, you know, a few days on the lunar surface, building up to a sustained presence on the lunar surface. But all of those things take their roots from the work that our incredible geology team have done with the Artemis II.
How have you found the public reaction to all of this? Because it, you know, when you look back now to remember that there was a time when people became quite blasé and then quite disinterested about the moon, and that was one of the reasons that we stopped going, to actually see people's renewed enthusiasm for it must be really gratifying for you.
I mean, it really is. You know, I think there was obviously huge support for going to the moon in the Apollo era. And then I think the focus changed and we really focused on living in space. And we've had our amazing International Space Station. We've had permanent presence in low Earth orbit for more than 20 years. Now, all the incredible science, medical research, quantum science, you know, biological, growing plants in space, all the things that we've learned on there, really setting us up for an incredible success. Now we're thinking about going back to the moon. And it isn't just about flags and footprints. It really is about building that infrastructure, building a moon base and having that permanent presence on the moon with, of course, eyes on Mars. You know, once you can live and work on the moon, you can actually start to really set up humans to be able to do that very, very long duration mission to Mars, because of course that isn't a 10-day out and back. It is at least 6 months. For me, it's just this is mission number one of many that we will enjoy, you know, as humanity.
Dr. Nikki Fox, Head of Science at NASA, it's great to talk to you, to experience that moment through your eyes. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And that brings us to 25 past eight. Kanye West has issued a statement in the last hour or so. My only goal, he says, is to come to London and present a show of change, bringing unity, peace and love through my music. I would be grateful for the opportunity to meet with members of the Jewish community in the UK in person to listen. The rapper, known as Ye, has been asked to perform at the Wireless Festival in London. He says he has bipolar disorder, which explains his previous behaviour, and anti-Semitism. The festival organisers say he should be forgiven. The sponsors, though, are pulling out, at least some of them, and the government is considering banning him from Britain. Just talking to us, well, a short while ago, half an hour or so, the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, said Kanye West should be seeking the forgiveness of Jewish communities.
Should he be headlining the Wireless Festival? Absolutely not. Look at his behaviour. Not one or two off-colour remarks. He released a song called Heil Hitler, plastered it across T-shirts, issued a mealy-mouthed and self-serving apology, and now expects people to feel sorry for him. I'm only too sorry that the festival organisers have chosen to platform him given that behaviour and then to offer the fig leaf of credibility with an absolutely absurd statement issued overnight. Look, if he wants forgiveness, it's not my forgiveness that he needs. It's the forgiveness of Jewish communities, and I don't think he's done anything to earn it.
That was Wes Streeting. Let us talk to Melvin Benn, who is one of those organisers. He's the managing director of the Festival Republic, which is the organisation that runs the Wireless Festival. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
What's the case for bringing him here?
Well, I suppose there's a case that culturally he is a really important artist. Culturally, he is played across the radio stations and enjoyed by millions of people across the UK. He is able to perform in other countries. He played in Los Angeles two nights last week to 70,000 people each night. No issues there, no furore. And his performances were enjoyed by the thousands of fans that were there. So, you know, he has made abhorrent statements. Of course he has. And they're equally abhorrent to me as they were, as they are to, you know, members of the Jewish community, members of, you know, Parliament.
If I can just stop you there, maybe not equally abhorrent, because maybe those people who are the targets of these statements should be the ones that you reach out to and ask whether he should come or not. I'm just curious to know whether you've done
that.
We have reached out
and they've refused to meet him. I have reached out and they've refused to meet him.
When did you do that?
Just over the last couple of days.
Right.
Really.
Should you not have done it before when you were making the decision about whether to bring, hang on a second, to bring to the country someone who has issued swastika T-shirts, someone who brought out a song called Heil Hitler? Should you not at an early stage have said to Jewish groups in this country, you okay with this?
Yeah, potentially we should have done, Justin, and that may prove to be a mistake that we've made. But, you know, so potentially we should have done. We did with Pepsi, for instance, our lead sponsor, and they signed off and approved it, for example, and perhaps we should have done.
Really? That's fascinating. Sorry to interrupt again, but that's fascinating. So Pepsi, who've pulled out now, haven't they? Pepsi originally were quite happy for him to come.
Correct. Yes, they're our headline sponsor. We asked them and asked them to sign off on it, and they did. And you know, perhaps we should have done the same with the Jewish community, and that may prove to be a mistake. But there's a very serious issue of mental health. Mental health is not something that disappears overnight. It's not an instant thing. People suffer psychotic behaviour, suffer bipolar behaviour for, you know, many, many years, and people can. You know, believe that they have, you know, thoughts in their mind where, you know, God or other people are determining what they should say, and their statements and their behaviour becomes despicable and absolutely abhorrent. And I think people are forgetting that because of the nature of the statement. The nature of the statement is absolutely disgusting that he made.
Well, it's not just one statement, is it? It's quite a few. The point about the mental illness episode. So people, and also the fact that he has apologised before and then retracted the apology. I mean, doesn't that suggest to you that this behaviour cannot simply be explained by his mental health?
Well, actually, I would suggest that it can be explained by his mental health. As someone that lives very close to someone with mental health issues, yes, I would suggest that actually it can be explained by his mental health issues, Justin.
So do Jews in this country, Jewish people living here whose children are going to school amid extraordinary security who are attacked, who have come under attack in synagogues, who feel themselves to be under the kind of pressure that they have not been in this country in modern times. When he comes here, are they just to say, well, the guy's got a mental illness, we should look the other way?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I mean, the pressure that the Jewish community is under at the moment is immense. And, you know, I feel for them in that sense. And I speak on their behalf, you know, not for them because I'm not of that community. But I speak with my staff about the pressure that they're under, for example, and how we need to be supportive of that and those communities. But at the same time...
But you haven't been. Isn't that the point? I mean, I hear those words, but they will hear those words this morning. You haven't been supportive of them.
Yes, but people of faith should have forgiveness in their heart, Justin.
But you can't tell them to forgive. It's up to them.
No, I'm not telling them. I'm not telling them. I'm asking them.
And if they say no?
Well, if they say no, they have the right to that opinion. Of course they do.
But they don't have the right to have the ability to say to you, this was a mistake and you should rescind the invitation.
They have that right, but they shouldn't have that. No single person should have the right to, other than Parliament. And Parliament, you know, it may be that the Home Secretary does rescind the opportunity, well, rescind his visa. He has a visa already issued to appear, to come into the country. And the Home Secretary may well rescind that today. I don't know. If she does, she does. And then, you know, the issue is over in terms of his appearance.
Has he actually got a visa, do you know?
I'm sorry?
Has he actually had a visa yet? Has he applied for one?
Yeah, no, he has a visa. He has a visa. He has an approved visa. That is correct, Justin.
Right.
I've seen that visa.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So he has an approved visa. He has the right to come at the moment. And if the Home Secretary were to act, she'd be rescinding that visa.
And the Home Secretary has the right to rescind it. Of course she does. And, you know, we'll see what she says later in the day.
Have you had any contact with the Home Office about him coming?
We've had contact with the DCMS, but not the Home Office.
And can you share with us what that contact was? In other words, have they come to you, or did you go to them?
Both. We had an open discussion with the DCMS, and the DCMS will, are feeding back. My understanding is the DCMS are feeding back the results of that open discussion to the Home Secretary before this morning's
meeting.
Just
to be clear about the visa, the visa was issued. Is it one that he had anywhere, or the visa was issued for him to come to this festival?
Well, it's not for him to come to the festival. It's for him to come to the country. And if he comes to the country, he has no reason not to perform.
But
at
it,
the
was issued, it was issued by during the course of this government's tenure in order that he could come in July when the festival is. Is that right?
Yeah, it's been issued in the last few days. It's been issued in the last few... 100%. It's been issued over the last few days, Justin.
Just a final thought then about people who will be amazed that he has been invited, horrified by the things that he has said. You are saying to them this morning that they have the right to object, which they obviously do, but their objections cannot stop him coming if the Home Secretary lets him come.
Well, that would be the legal position, yes.
But is it your ethical position as well?
I think as per my statement yesterday, Justin, I want to give people a second chance. And I think Kanye West, Ye as he is now officially known, should be given a second chance and should be able to become an advocate for the very same community that he has upset so much.
Would he be able to perform Heil Hitler at the festival?
No, absolutely not.
How would you know? How would you be able to stop him though?
Because we will have our hands on the microphone controls at all times, Justin. I've done that many times in the past.
Right, because, of course, we have very recent experience of that not going very well. But you're saying he would be cut off if he said anything objectionable at any stage?
100% he would, yes.
Melvin Byrne, thank you very much for talking to us this morning.
It's time for the sport at 26 minutes to nine. Cathy's back.
Morning, thank you very much. The Coventry City manager Frank Lampard admits they need to cut out the noise and just deal with Sheffield Wednesday. That's their next match on Saturday. Coventry City are now just 4 points away from promotion back to the Premier League after a 0-0 draw with Hull City last night. Moving up into the Championship are Lincoln City, who've been promoted to football's second tier. They beat Reading 2-1. Manchester City will face Chelsea in the semi-finals of the Women's FA Cup after beating Birmingham City 1-0. Chelsea defeated Spurs 2-1 yesterday, and Liverpool face Brighton in the final four of that competition. Arsenal face Sporting in Lisbon tonight in the quarter-finals of the Men's Champions League. And there's commentary of that match on 5 Live from 8pm. Now, golf's Masters starts on Thursday, and after being beaten by Rory McIlroy in an emotional playoff in last year's tournament, England's Justin Rose is aware that he is many golf fans' sentimental favourite to win this year. I've been speaking to the BBC's golf correspondent Ian Carter, who's been chatting to the main contenders in Augusta, and started by asking how confident Rose is sounding at the start of Masters Week.
Well, Rose lost the playoff to Rory McIlroy last year, the second time he's lost out on a green jacket in sudden death, and the third time he's been runner-up overall. So there's no one with a better record in the field who has not won a Masters previously. We saw him yesterday. He looked relaxed. He's already won on the PGA Tour this year. And, of course, he has this great record at Augusta. But equally, he knows he'll have to manage his emotions this week.
I've already experienced, you know, a lot of people are wishing me well or thinking it's going to be my year or whatever, you know, just based around sentiment, you know what I mean? So I'm going to have to manage that a little bit this week. And, you know, that's going to be a part of my week this week for sure, is people remembering what happened last year. So that's fine. But, you know, I've got to kind of like be aware of that, be ready for that, and make that. I've got to have my own narrative and not like kind of buy into everyone else's narrative.
Speaking of the narrative surrounding the Masters, it's the first time in just over 30 years that both Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson are missing from the Masters. How much of a talking point has that been?
Well, I suppose it does feel like a changing of the guard, even though neither player has been a genuine contender for a number of years. Mickelson is absent due to family health matters. Woods is believed to have checked himself into a Swiss treatment centre following his recent car crash. The game's two biggest personalities, therefore, leave a void in the talking, if not the playing, this week. And that's where the likes of defending champion McIlroy, the world number one Scotty Scheffler, the Liv star, Bryson DeChambeau and John Rahm, that's where they come to the fore. And it all really adds up to what I think is going to be a fascinating week with any number of potential winners.
Looking forward to it. Ian Carter, thank you. Ian Carter, who's in Augusta, but not going to the annual Champions Dinner, which is tonight. That's where the reigning champion traditionally chooses the meal served to the former winners in the Augusta Clubhouse and Rory McIlroy's menu. You may have heard it before. It's caused quite a stir because it's now the most expensive Champions Dinner at around $318 a head. And McIlroy himself has to pay that, but I don't think he'll mind.
No, it's a step up from a bag of chips.
Yes, well, actually, you did have Bob Watson, who's dinner was just likened to a Burger Brand's Happy Meal by Sir Nick Faldo. So I think Faldo might be slightly happy with McIlroy's choice of meal tonight.
I think he probably will. Thank you, Carthy. Now let's look ahead to 9 o'clock here on Radio 4 with Jim Al-Khalili.
Hello. Anyone who's fascinated by astronomy and space will be familiar with the many beautiful high-resolution images of everything from supernova explosions to distant spiral galaxies. But my guest today is working on a project so ambitious it makes those still images seem rather boring. Hirania Pieras is an astrophysicist, part of a team creating a movie of the universe. Their digital camera is the size of a car, and the data it produces is so great it needs AI to analyse it. The first results I've seen are utterly mind-blowing. Join me as I unpack Hirania's picture of the cosmos after the news at 9 or catch up on BBC Sounds.
The weather sunny and warm for most today. Cloudy in the northwest. There's showery rain in the afternoon.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Anna Foster, and Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news at 21 minutes to 9.
NASA's Artemis 2 mission is on its way back to Earth after travelling around the far side of the moon and witnessing a solar eclipse. One of the four astronauts on board the Orion spacecraft said they'd seen sights that no human had ever seen. The head of science at NASA, Nikki Fox, told us she'd teared up a number of times while following the journey. President Trump has repeated his threat to destroy bridges and power plants in Iran tonight if the country doesn't agree to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Separately, the Israeli military has this morning told people in Iran not to use trains or go near railway lines. Resident doctors in England have begun a 6-day strike in a dispute about pay and job opportunities. NHS bosses have told patients to seek care as normal. The American rapper Kanye West has offered to meet members of the Jewish community in the UK in response to calls for his performance at a festival in London to be cancelled because of anti-Semitic comments he'd made in the past. He says he wants to address directly those he's hurt. Caroline, thank you. It's 20 to 9 now. Let's pick up on that story about Kanye West due to headline the Wireless Festival just a few moments ago. You heard Justin talking to the organiser of that festival, Melvin Benn, defending his decision to invite Kanye West to perform and to stick with that decision as well, despite the controversy that it's created. Well, Michael Weeger joins us now, the chief executive of the Board of Deputies of British Jews. Good morning. I wanted to put some of those points that Melvin Benn made to you to get your response to them. The first was his justification for inviting Kanye West, who's known as Ye nowadays. He said that he was a culturally important artist, that his music is still played on radio and enjoyed. He said that he still plays in other countries, including in the US in the last few days. And for him, he said that was sufficient justification for him to appear, well, not just to appear, to headline Wireless.
It's hard to imagine if an artist had made appalling statements about black people, about Muslim people, about LGBTQ people, that there will be such a group of people such as Ben moving to defend them and wanting to platform them here. We think that the continued insistence by Mr. Ben that Kanye West should appear at the Wireless Festival is a disgrace. The idea that he accepts, he wants to forgive, as opposed to it's the Jewish community who needs to either agree or not to agree forgiveness, is ludicrous. So our position has not changed, and we strongly believe that Kanye West should not be at the performing, leading at the Wireless Festival.
Mm. He said that you, and by you he meant the Jewish community, should have forgiveness in your heart. He said, I want to give people a second chance, and his suggestion was that you didn't. What would you say to that?
We would say that a man who has repeatedly made appalling anti-Semitic statements, including Holocaust denial, including delegitimizing the position of Jewish people everywhere to live their Jewish lives, has got no business performing at a festival in London. If Kanye West wants to meet the Jewish community, that's something that possibly we would be considered to do. We might be agreed to do that. However, that should be disconnected from his appearing this July at the Wireless Festival in Simsbury Park. Those are two different things, and we think it entirely appropriate the invitation is withdrawn and that Kanye West not appear.
Melvin Benn said that he reached out to the Jewish community to request a meeting, which was refused. Now, I don't know if that was you specifically, but one would imagine that if you were trying to speak to the Jewish community in the UK, that you would be a good place to start. Did you have contact with him requesting a meeting that you refused?
No, that's not the case. And there has been some discussion in very recent days, but we have not refused to meet him and we would be prepared to meet him. However, our position has not changed. We do not think that Kanye West should be appearing this July at the festival.
What is your opinion on the argument that his behaviour, his anti-Semitic behaviour, to be clear, can be explained by his mental health, by his bipolar disorder?
So we are terribly sympathetic to anyone who has mental health disorders. And of course, we wish Mr. West a complete recovery on those. And if in the process of that recovery, there is a reconciliation built over a long time and over actual actions with the Jewish community, then perhaps forgiveness can be asked for and be received. But to put out now this call for forgiveness, which is clearly a desperate act to save the concert, we do not think is appropriate.
And your message to the government, because Melvin Benn did say that there had been a visa issued to him to come and perform. He said that visa was issued in the last few days. But of course, it is in the gift of the Home Secretary to rescind that. Is that something that you believe should happen, that he should not simply be removed from the festival, but he should be told that he can't travel to the UK and that visa should be revoked?
So I'm not, of course, familiar with all of the legal implications of that, but if it's possible for the Home Secretary to withdraw the visa, we would entirely approve of that.
Michael Weeger, thank you for joining us, the Chief Executive of the Board of Deputies of British Jews. Worth saying that Henry Zeffman, our Chief Political Correspondent, is on to the government trying to establish what their position is on that at the moment.
Yeah, particularly in the light of the fact that we were told by the organisers of the festival that this visa to come and perform was issued over the last few days, as they put it to us. So it'll be interesting to hear what they have to say about that. Time now, 9:15. This is a day, of course, potentially huge consequence for the whole world, certainly for Iran and for the Gulf states that remain vulnerable to Iranian attack. Donald Trump says he is waiting until this evening in Washington before deciding whether to bomb Iranian infrastructure, bridges, power plants, etc.
Would he really do it? David Satterfield is a former US Middle East envoy under President Biden. I asked him whether there was any way of telling, actually, what President Trump is likely to do next.
I think the one thing that we can say is that the president is increasingly frustrated, increasingly angry that this situation, the situation being Iran's continued resistance to entering into what the president would define as satisfactory negotiations, the blockage of the Strait of Hormuz, the continued missile attacks, that all of this has not resolved itself with the ease that last June's 3 hours of U.S. strikes on the nuclear facilities and then the abduction of Venezuelan President Maduro so quickly resolved themselves. This was a different, more complex situation. But if we go beyond his frustration and anger to where does it take him, no, I don't think we can be certain. Is tomorrow evening indeed a deadline? If it is, what indeed are the consequences? What civil infrastructure is to be hit? And I think most importantly, what would be the consequence? Now, most analysis, my own, is that Iran believes it's winning this. It's an asymmetrical conflict, and they have the upper hand. They're able to continue to impose pain on all of their neighbors in the Gulf, and above all, they can keep the strait closed despite all of the military action. Would that be different if there were to be massive damage to bridges, to power stations, as the president has threatened? I think the regime would view their ability to raise the pressure on the president and survive is greater than his ability to bring fundamental pressure to bear on them.
And of course, part of that pressure from Iran might be on civilian infrastructure in the Gulf states. And one wonders what the Gulf states are now saying to President Trump about what he, in their view, should do next.
Well, the Gulf states are in a real dilemma here. All of them wish to see Iran reduced in terms of its conventional weaponry, its nuclear potential, to a point where Iran cannot threaten. There's no doubt about that at all. They don't want to continue to be exposed to an Iranian threat, whether it's on their own territory through missile and drone attack or closure of the strait, which is vital to their economic life. But on the other hand, they've seen this campaign go on for 5 weeks now, and Iran continues to be able to attack them. Kuwait was hit quite badly over the course of the last 36 hours. So they're caught. They want it to end, but not with Iran in a dominant position. But unfortunately, that's exactly the position Iran is in right now.
And when it comes to the Strait of Hormuz, which is, of course, part of the symptom, as it were, of that position, can you see a situation where the Gulf states, indeed the rest of the world, simply allow things to go back to as they were, with the potential always that Iran closes that strait? Or are we in different territory, do you think?
Well, that is an excellent question. And a few weeks ago, the broad assumption would be the president could simply declare victory, bring the campaign to a close, and the strait would open again. Lots of unresolved issues, but the strait would reopen. But now the Iranians seem determined to hold out over not just the Gulf states, but the world, the potential that it can't go back the way it was, that they will extract some new concession. This is an international waterway. It is not the property of Iran to bargain over. And that's fine for me to declare or an international law specialist to state. But the fact is Iran has the upper hand here. So will it go back to the way it was before? Is Iran willing to see that as the price it pays for an end to the campaign? I don't know. That's certainly not what Iran is signaling right now.
Final thought, as an international law expert, on the legality or otherwise of an attack if he does launch an attack or a series of attacks on infrastructure targets. There is a suggestion, isn't there, from quite a few people around the world, including allies, potentially including Britain, that it would be illegal to do that. It would be potentially a war crime. What's your view?
The law of armed conflict, which covers these situations, is quite complex. And I would be very hesitant to make a judgment in advance of whether a specific act was or was not likely to be criminal or illegal in its character. But I will say this.
broad destruction deliberately of civil infrastructure, which is not directly associated with the activities that have prompted the campaign, the nuclear program, the missile attacks. That is going into a very gray area, and the broader the scope of the destruction, the grayer, the darker the area becomes. But I certainly wouldn't make a legal judgment on this.
Ambassador David Satterfield, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
It's 10 to 9 now. Many of us like the idea of committing our own lives to paper. It's growing in popularity. And now the award-winning author and poet Blake Morrison has written a guide to doing it. It's called On Memoir. And he joins us in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
It seems like a useful guide, because when asked for most of us to get the very essence of our own lives and put it on paper, where to start, I suppose, is one question, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm a serial offender, I'm afraid. I wrote one about my father, one about my mother, and then one about my sister and half-sister. And I felt I learned a few things. And I guess I've worked with a lot of students at Goldsmiths University and other writers trying to do it, and had a few thoughts and suggestions. And then, you know, I read a lot of memoirs. I feel enthusiastic about the form that it sometimes looked down on, and wanted to recommend things that people can read.
What do you think makes a good memoir? Because it can be sometimes so deeply personal that it maybe resonates with the writer, but not necessarily with anybody else. And I suppose that's the balance you're trying to reach, isn't it?
That's the balance. I mean, I think the personal can be universal. And I think one of the joys in a good memoir is are those moments of recognition where you say, well, gosh, I went through something like that too. And this author has put down thoughts and feelings that I wasn't able to articulate. And so there's this... Yeah, there's a cathartic effect, even a therapeutic effect for both the writer and the reader in an ideal world.
Yeah, and obviously when you wrote about your father, it was after his death, but not too long after his death. Did you pick a particular moment where you felt that you were ready, but also there was still a degree of perhaps rawness in there as well that you would want to channel?
There was rawness. I mean, some people say, oh, you should never write a memoir until 10 years have passed and you've processed it all. I wrote that book in the 11 months after my father died, and it was very raw. It was about dealing with grief and dealing with memory. But then I wrote one about my mother, which is totally different, about finding my mother after a death rather than a book about my father, which was about losing him. And I was drawing on all these letters that my father had kept that had exchanged long before I was thought of. And, you know, that one was more researched and took a lot longer. So it can vary enormously.
Yeah.
What I do think is, you know, these days there are what you might call nobody memoirs. You know, somebody used that term. You know, you don't have to be famous to write one. It's not a retired politician or rock star looking back on a career. It might be just something you've been through, you know, and the memoir is a way of dealing with whatever that was.
Yeah. And as you say, sometimes it is the universality of it, you know, the fact that those experiences are shared experiences. And even if it's somebody ordinary, as you say, that you might find something in it that brings to mind your own experience.
Absolutely. I think one of the big issues for memoir writers is about consent and permission. You know, you are going to probably be writing about living people. What do you do? Do you ask their permission? Some memoir writers say, yeah, I ask everybody. Unless they were totally happy with it, I wouldn't go ahead. And others say, well, you know, if they wanted me to write well about them, they should have behaved better.
Well, I mean, and that, I suppose that goes back to that process of catharsis, because when you're writing, it's not the same as going to therapy and you're perhaps bouncing your ideas off somebody else. It's just you. They're just going round and round in your own mind. So you're having to sort of pull that catharsis from yourself.
Yeah, and I think it's the act of writing that is the cathartic element. It's not a splurge. You're not just pouring it all out. You're shaping it, finding a way to tell this story. And that is, if you like, the healing thing when you're doing a memoir.
So in On Memoir, where, as you say, you've spent so many years not just writing your own, but teaching as well to people who want to write their own, what are the key thoughts and themes that you pull together to try and make that a not just an easier experience, but a more enriching experience for somebody?
Well, I have, you know, it's not a teaching primer. And I think I've got a section where I say I've got tentative commandments, and rather than laying down the law. But one of the things I do emphasise, I guess, is truth-telling. I mean, I think there should be a relationship of trust between writer and reader. And if the reader feels this person has made this up, hence, you know, the big controversy last year over Raina Wynne's The Salt, Salt Path where there was information was suppressed or so on. So I say, you know, it's a tough, you have to be brave to be candid and honest about personal stuff that's happened to you.
That's a good point as well, because if people, I mean, you mentioned The Salt Path and the reaction to that, because if people have invested in you, not just as a writer of fiction or whatever it may be, but as you, somebody who has unveiled your own life, there is perhaps a higher level of investment, isn't there, from the reader?
I think there is. I think Philip Roth, the American novelist, said, you know, it's different from a novel. Somehow you're judged ethically. You're judged as a human being for the memoir, whereas maybe a novelist or a poet would be judged aesthetically. You're in there as a personality that the reader has got to know. And so there has to be that, that trust between the two of you.
Yeah. It's fascinating. Blake Morrison, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about it. That new guide is called On Memoir.
4 minutes to nine is the time. Let us finish by discussing once again the issue of Kanye West and his planned visit to this country. You may have heard half an hour or so ago the festival chief, Wireless Festival, who've invited him. He's coming in July, saying that the Jewish community should forgive him. People of faith should have forgiveness in their heart, Mr. Ben told us, and I'm asking them to forgive. He also said, interestingly, that he should perhaps have reached out to Jewish people earlier in the whole process, but also that the visa for Kanye West to come here had been issued within the last few days. Let us talk to Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent, who is on the line. And, of course, it goes now to the government, doesn't it? Because we also heard from Wes Streeting earlier in the programme, who didn't say we need to ban him, but made it pretty clear that he didn't want him to come.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think in terms of the process of all of this, the most striking line of Melvin Benn's interview with you was when he claimed that Kanye West already has a visa to come to the UK. That was not our understanding at the BBC of the situation. We'd not formally been given a quote from the Home Office attesting to that, but it was strongly indicated that he had not yet submitted an application to come to the UK. It may well be that Melvin Benn is wrong. I've asked the Home Office, I mean, almost seconds after Melvin Benn said that on air, haven't had an answer yet on what the position is. But that is going to be an important thing to clarify over the course of the day. However, I think, given what Wes Streeting said on this programme, given that the Prime Minister has said in recent days that he's deeply concerned by this, I think it is hard to see Kanye West being allowed to come to the UK for these performances, whether that amounts to refusing a visa application or revoking a visa that has already been granted.
And the government has the right to do that, has the power to do that, or the Home Secretary does?
The Home Secretary has to come to a judgment that he would not be, his presence in the UK would not be conducive to the public good. Now, you saw Wes Streeting on this programme and on others this morning trying to draw a line between his assessment that Melvin Benn, who you interviewed, has made a terrible error of judgment, I think his words were, and drawing a line between that and the legal bar that the Home Office must clear in determining that Kanye West is not conducive to the public good. So I'm not saying it's a dead cert that he is not allowed into the country. That is a legal process. But it seems pretty clear that the government, at least on political terms, has set itself against this appearance going ahead. And worth noting, by the way, I mean, I'm not sure I've seen any politician of any party say that they believe it should go ahead.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because it isn't just the government. It is actually the politicians, certainly the other major parties, who also don't want it to come.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a broad political consensus on that, it seems. I mean, let's see. You know, it's been an Easter weekend. It may well be that other political parties and or some members of different political parties might have different opinions. But right now, it feels like Melvin Benn and the festival organisers are pretty isolated, politically isolated from their sponsors and so on.